You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Dick and Don were all through this time part of this COG group, continuity of government, where they were practicing, essentially practicing to take over the United States government in time of crisis. The only time that that plan was ever implemented was on 9/11 by Richard Clark, one of their COG associates. So they planned to take over the government over these decades, in and out of government themselves, and they changed the plan in 1998 for it to be a response to a terrorist event, just exactly the kind of event that happened on September 11th. And then on September 11th, they implemented this plan. So one thing about that plan is that since then we've learned that it may still be in effect. It definitely was still in effect the year after 9/11, and it continued apparently to be left in place to some degree. Now, a lot of us are not sure what that means, to what extent, and the reason we don't know what it means is that U.S. congressmen cannot even get information about it. Some congressmen have asked specifically for information on the continuity of government plan, whether it's still in effect, what it means, and they have been told that they cannot access that information.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 1. Kevin Ryan began to investigate the crimes of September 11th, 2001, through his work as site manager for a division of Underwriters Laboratories, or UL. As a manager at Underwriters, he began in 2003 to question the World Trade Center investigation being conducted by UL and the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, and UL's work to ensure the fire resistance of the buildings. Ryan lost his position at UL for making his questions public. He was a founding member of the 9/11 Working Group of Bloomington and Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. From 2009 to 2011, he volunteered his time as a board director at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He now serves as co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He has co-authored several books and peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject. His latest book is Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, released in 2013. Kevin Ryan, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back on the show, Kevin. We haven't talked in quite a while, it seems.
It seems like it's been a few years, Bonnie. It's great to hear your voice.
Now, you have a new book out, Another 19. What is the basic concept behind your new book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects? The U.S. government named 19 individuals, mostly Saudis, of instigating the events of September 11th, 2001. You have written a book about 19 high-level government, corporate, and intelligence officials whose behavior for decades before September 11th calls into question their involvement in these events. In your introduction to the book, you mention, quote, the politically minded rich, a group otherwise referred to as the overworld, and the connections between important operations such as the October Surprise, Iran-Contra, Operation Gladio, the First Gulf War, and 9/11. In your research, do you find the same individuals popping up in all of these events?
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of what I'm trying to show here. After learning about 9/11 and the history of other deep state events, I've found that those events have a lot of people that seem to pop in and out of history and show up in things. You mentioned Iran-Contra. I also go through the Phoenix program in Vietnam a little bit. Another big one are the lies behind the First Gulf War. And so the reason I wrote the book is that many people know now that the official investigations and the official reports for 9/11 don't explain some of the major aspects of what happened. They really have not been sufficient in explaining the unanswered questions. And I go through some of those. I focus on what has not been explained and who might have been in position to accomplish the parts of the attacks that have not been explained. And in doing so, as you said, I found that these people seem to be interlaced and interwoven with history of other state crimes and other deep state events. So I go into quite a bit of detail in the book, and it's for people who really want to learn more about 9/11 and are really interested in the subject.
How did investigations in the 1970s into CIA crimes, such as assassinations of political leaders around the world, known as the family jewels, lead to the formation of a private covert network of intelligence operatives? What can you tell us about the history of this private network that formed in the late 70s and how that history developed?
Well, the history goes back, as you said, to the mid-70s when the CIA was under fire publicly by several congressional investigations. And there were legal actions taken, and there were tools put in place for the public to try to control these agencies, the CIA in particular. And what happened as a result of that, with the blessing of then CIA Director George H.W. Bush, is that some of the people who were working in the U.S. intelligence service connected with foreign intelligence services like that of the Saudi government and like that of a group called the Safari Club, which included the Saudis and the Iranians and other countries. And they found ways to act as proxies around the world for each other. So essentially, the CIA was prohibited from doing certain things, from conducting certain operations after these congressional investigations. And so what they did is they essentially contracted the work out covertly. It was off-the-books operations. And a big part of that, the need for funding came about in a way that created something called the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. And actually, this bank existed, but it was developed by the Saudis at the request of a man named Clark Clifford, who was a high-level, powerful person in the United States. And the BCCI became essentially a terrorist financing network. And as you read through the book, Another 19, you see many links to BCCI, and they're very compelling in terms of the ability for people to, for example, place explosives in the World Trade Center. The company that's most likely to have been able to do that was a company called Stratesec, and I go into great detail about that and the company's links to BCCI. And anyway, this network was essentially a covert operations network funded through this terrorist financing group called BCCI, which was basically run by the CIA through its subsidiary, First American Bank. And this network was very closely linked to the Bush family. Many people have written about this in the past. I'm certainly not the first one. In my book, it really is just kind of laying the history that others have already covered and showing how that history links very well to various aspects of the 9/11 attacks.
The first two persons that you give a detailed history of are Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Let's start with Donald Rumsfeld. What do we know about him? And didn't he on several occasions make prescient predictions about the 9/11 attacks?
Oh, yes, absolutely he did. Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld in this book are essentially the alternative Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They are the two people who were in perfect position to coordinate the attacks of 9/11 because of their roles. For Dick Cheney, as vice president of the United States, he was in charge at the White House that day, with the president traveling around the country indisposed. And Donald Rumsfeld, as the Secretary of Defense, was in position at the Pentagon to coordinate what happened there and the lack of national air defenses. Donald Rumsfeld is a character who has been described by Richard Nixon as a ruthless little bastard, and he kept that reputation throughout his career. One thing about Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney is that they were in government periodically over years, but throughout the 30 years before 9/11, they were part of a group called the Continuity of Government Group. It's a secret. It was a secret group that planned to basically ensure that the government continued without, unfortunately, congressional approval. They would basically take over the government in a coup if a certain national emergency occurred. At first, those emergencies were based around the a threat of a Soviet attack on the United States. And that, in the late 90s, was revised. That plan was revised so that this COG plan, this continuity of government plan, would be in response to a terrorist event as well. And now, the interesting thing is this plan was revised by another member of the very small group that was responsible for it, and that member was a man named Richard Clark, who was a close associate of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. But as I said, Donald Rumsfeld was in perfect position to coordinate certain parts of the attack, and what he really did is he apparently allowed the attacks to go forward, and he had, it seemed, some knowledge that they were going to attack the Pentagon. He made that kind of prediction, as you said. He made these very prescient predictions, saying that this would be a great, essentially this would be an excellent place to attack. He made several comments about the need for a new Pearl Harbor and that he expected a Pearl Harbor to occur. And so he made himself, unfortunately for him, I think in historical terms, that he's going to continue to look like someone who really needs to be investigated for his possible involvement in the attacks.
What can you tell us about the history of Donald Rumsfeld? He has quite a varied history, doesn't he, starting, like you say, 30, 40 years ago?
Absolutely. He was a guy who he initially worked for an investment brokerage called A.G. Becker. And that was kind of his stepping stone into Congress. And he was elected to Congress after having taken a job with A.G. Becker for a year or two. And he was in Congress for a period of time, and he was a close associate of Gerald Ford, who ended up becoming president after Richard Nixon resigned. And Donald Rumsfeld, just prior to that, prior to Ford becoming president, in the few years before that, he was somehow made a special assistant to President Nixon. So he seemed to get very strong favorite treatment from the government. Somehow he was made part of the cabinet and a special assistant to President Nixon, and then he hired on Dick Cheney to be his assistant. And the two of them really skyrocketed politically in terms of just getting this favored treatment, this ability to somehow just rise through the ranks and gain power over a period of time in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Donald Rumsfeld was the ambassador to NATO, and this was at the height of the Operation Gladio crimes. And what people should know is that the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, working through NATO, was the person who was in charge of the operation. The Operation Gladio crimes were being committed by a CIA-linked group that were led by the NATO forces, the NATO commander in Brussels. And at that same time, Donald Rumsfeld was the ambassador to NATO in Brussels. So, it's not necessarily definitive that Donald Rumsfeld was somehow involved in Operation Gladio. But there are other connections with regard to Operation Gladio and some of these suspects. Paul Bremer was strongly connected to Alexander Haig, who is also one of those Supreme Allied commanders who would have been in charge of Operation Gladio at the time. So, and one thing I mentioned in my book that of the 19 suspects that I've identified, at least half of them worked in some way for the Nixon or Ford administrations, and that's when these CIA crimes were being revealed and the congressional investigations were going on, and Cheney and Rumsfeld were really defending the CIA as White House representatives, and these other people, Carlucci, for example, and Richard Clark and Paul Bremer, and Rudy Giuliani were all working in the Ford and Nixon administrations. And so they all seem to tie together going back to this history of when the CIA crimes were being revealed and this new network was being developed.
I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 1. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Both Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are readily identified as part of the Ford administration, but in fact, as you pointed out, the first administration that the two of them worked in was Nixon's. What was the reason for including Dick Cheney in the other 19?
Well, Dick Cheney was, as I said, he was really in charge at the White House, and he was the man who originally took charge in the underground Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC. And so a piece of evidence that many 9/11 investigators have focused on is the testimony of Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta. And there's some controversy about when Vice President Cheney actually arrived in the PEOC Center and therefore was in control of what was going on in the response that basically failed. Norman Mineta's testimony suggested that not only was Dick Cheney there very early before 9:30 in the morning, but he had given orders of some kind, and a young man was coming in periodically and checking to see if those orders still stood. The orders related to a plane that was coming towards Washington that Mineta stated was the plane that was said to have hit the Pentagon, Flight 77. So Dick Cheney was in charge of the White House. He was apparently giving orders. And by the way, Norman Mineta has stood by that testimony over the years, that Dick Cheney was tracking this plane in some way, had given orders about it. We're not sure what kind of orders. All this contradicts the official account. And Dick Cheney has also, early this year, come out and made it clear that he really was in charge, and he was basically telling the president to stay away from Washington. And many people have noted that Dick Cheney seems to have given an order to shoot down the fourth plane, United 93. So I go into a good deal of the evidence related to those things and also the background of Dick Cheney. One thing about Dick and Don, as I call them in the book, and those are their names, but basically we know for a fact that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were behind the lies that started the Iraq War. They led a campaign, a coordinated campaign of lies to start the Iraq War by falsely claiming that Iraq was somehow associated with 9/11, and the Niger documents about the yellow cake were forged, and the aluminum tubes that they talked about to the New York Times, that was all false. So Dick and Don lied to start this huge war that killed a million people. Plus, Dick was also behind the lies of the first that started the first Gulf War. And he was behind, along with another suspect in this book, his protege, Duane Andrews, he was behind the lies about the satellite imagery that said that that Saddam Hussein had huge numbers of troops at the Saudi border. That was false, it turned out. He was also apparently associated with the Hill and Knowlton campaign that encouraged this young woman, Naira al-Sabah, to falsely claim that Iraqi soldiers were taking babies out of incubators. The interesting thing about Naira is she's the first cousin of one of the other suspects that, she's the first cousin of Michelle al-Sabah of Kawam Corporation, and he worked closely with Work Walker, who was another of the suspects. So all this ties together to a great degree, and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld over the years appear to have been intimately involved in a number of these crimes.
Well, you also point out in your book that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld would move in and out of government, and they would publicly lose power, but really behind the scenes remain in power. You mentioned continuity of government, for one thing. Could you talk a little bit about what these two were up to when they didn't actually even hold public office?
Yes, absolutely. Dick Cheney was actually in government for a longer period of time. He was in Congress as a congressman from Wyoming not long after he left the Ford administration. One thing interesting about the little segue for his career is that he worked again for a company called Bradley Woods. And yet another of the suspects in this book now works closely with his partner, Bruce Bradley, from Bradley Woods, and that's Barry McDaniel of Strategic. But Dick Cheney worked in the government for a long period of time until the early 90s, and then he was hired as the CEO of Halliburton, a company that profited a great deal off of the wars that have resulted from 9/11. He also, as CEO of Halliburton, was clearly breaking the law in terms of doing business with Iran and Iraq and some of the countries that supposedly are, you know, the enemies of the United States. Donald Rumsfeld has been an executive for a number of companies, and he was the youngest Secretary of Defense during the Ford administration, and then one of the oldest as George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. In between, though, he held a lot of different pseudo-government positions, you know, as kind of the special envoy to the Middle East for Reagan, and also as the RAND Corporation CEO, the RAND Corporation being kind of a policy-making pseudo-private corporation associated with the Pentagon. And as you said, we discussed earlier, Dick and Don were all through this time part of this COG group, Continuity of Government, where they were essentially practicing to take over the United States government in time of crisis. The only time that that plan was ever implemented was on 9/11 by Richard Clark, one of their COG associates. So they planned to take over the government over this whole over these decades, in and out of government themselves, and they changed the plan in 1998 for it to be a response to a terrorist event, just exactly the kind of event that happened on September 11th. And then on September 11th, they implemented this plan. The one thing about that plan is that since then we've learned that it may still be in effect. It definitely was still in effect the year after 9/11, and it continued apparently to be left in place to some degree. A lot of us are not sure what that means, to what extent. And the reason we don't know what it means is that U.S. congressmen cannot even get information about it. Some congressmen have asked specifically for information on the continuity of government plan, whether it's still in effect, what it means. And they have been told that they cannot access that information. So Dick and Don have been, over the many years between the early 70s through the George W. Bush administration, really powerful figures, whether they were in government or not.
In fact, all of the other 19 that you go through in quite a lot of detail in your book, all of these people are in and out of government but retain a lot of power when they're not in government, right? They all seem to be jumping from one company to another, to intelligence agencies, back into government. So all of these 19 people have never gone away for decades, right? They retain power.
That's exactly right, and people call this the revolving door to some extent, but I think with some of these people, it's a little higher level revolving door. One person, for example, is L. Paul Bremer, who is covered in the chapter on terrorism propaganda. He was Reagan's ambassador at large for counterterrorism, and then he went to become the managing director for Kissinger Associates, and then he came back to lead the National Commission on Terrorism. Another example is Paul Wolfowitz, who not only was in and out of government, but he, regardless of what political party was in power, Wolfowitz was always in a position of power. There are a few people over the years who have been like that. Robert Gates is another example of somebody who, no matter which political party is in power, is always somehow in a strong position in the government. And so, yes, this revolving door is definitely reflected in these 19 suspects. A guy named Dwayne Andrews is another one in the book that, led a company called SAIC, which is Science Applications International Corporation, which is just incredibly interesting in terms of the many, many links it has to 9/11. And Dwayne Andrews, as I said earlier, was the protege of Dick Cheney. He was Dick's intelligence man when Dick was Secretary of Defense in the George H.W. Bush administration. And after that, left to lead this company, SAIC. So these corporations and the government, there's really almost no barriers between them. And I think we see that today when we know that for example, most of the top secret clearances given out by the United States today are just to people who work for private companies. So most of the intelligence work in the United States is contracted out. And that can be frightening to a lot of people, knowing now that the government is spying on all of us continuously.
I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 1. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Frank Carlucci, former head of the investment firm The Carlyle Group, is the third major player mentioned among the other 19. What is his history, and what are some of the companies he has been affiliated with?
Well, Frank Carlucci is most well known for having been the CEO of The Carlyle Group. And The Carlyle Group is very interesting with regard to 9/11 because it was funded in part by the Bin Laden family, who were investors in the Carlyle Group. And they were investors and partners with the Bush family. The Bush family is very closely related to the Carlyle Group as well. So Carlucci is also, he comes into play in the book because he is very closely related to Donald Rumsfeld. He was Donald Rumsfeld's roommate at Princeton in the 50s. And since then, he's had a career as basically a covert operative. He worked ostensibly for the State Department, for the Foreign Service, as they said back in the day. And at that time, it was clear that people working for the State Department oftentimes might be these really covert operatives, and that's exactly what he was. Carlucci was run out of several countries over his career. He was accused of plotting the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, who was the president of the Congo in 1961. He's accused of overthrowing Salvador Allende in Chile. He's accused of being involved in coups in several other countries, and the kidnapping of Aldo Moro and other things in Portugal and so forth. So he's really considered a specialist in dirty work. And that's interesting because, you know, him being so powerful as the CEO of the Carlyle Group and having such connections to companies that actually reported through him, one of them being BDM International. And BDM International is really strongly connected to 9/11. And then again, this company, Stratesec, comes up because the chief operating officer and other employees from Stratesec came directly from Carlyle, Carlucci's BDM International. But Carlucci also has a history that appears to indicate that he was involved in the Iran-Contra crimes. He ran a company called Sears World Trade back then, and this company was considered a spook operation, basically, by people who worked there. It was a company that was found to be coordinating arms sales in the exact kinds of equipment that the Iran-Contra crimes involved. And essentially, newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer basically accused Sears World Trade and Carlucci of being involved in the Iran-Contra crimes. But he was never actually investigated for that. And one thing that, again, crops up, these people keep interlacing and showing up. Barry McDaniel from Stratesec was the man in charge of distributing the weapons for the U.S. at that very time, at the time of the Iran-Contra crimes. And so he was an expert on logistics for armaments and explosives and so forth, which is partly why he comes up again in the book later in his own chapter. So Carlucci was around the world. He spent time in countries around the world, mainly in Africa and in the Middle East. And he did make a reputation, and in Central America and South America, as being this heavy covert operative, and also was involved in the Atsco, you know, very closely associated with Ted Shackley and the people who were selling arms to Iran and so forth. So there's just an enormous amount of detail. But what we're trying to do with this discussion in this book is to show that these suspects just crop up in perfect positions in some cases to help affect the crimes of 9/11 and accomplish the things that have not been explained.
What is Frank Carlucci doing now?
So Frank Carlucci is no longer the chairman of the Carlyle Group. He left that job in 2003 and became the chairman emeritus for a few more years. But he's associated with a lot of other companies now, including primarily the Frontier Group, where he works with Norman Augustine, who had worked for InQtel. And he is also an advisory board member for DTU Satellite Solutions and for Nortel Networks, so into communications and satellite stuff. One thing other people have noted is he was also a primary advisor for Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential campaign. So he's definitely a strong Republican, and he continues to be associated with businesses at a high level, but no longer with government. And so I believe he's just kind of a guy who tries to influence policy as a private citizen. And so I think that he really needs to be investigated for 9/11 in terms of his connections to the Carlyle Group, to Barry McDaniel, to Donald Rumsfeld, and to the Bin Laden family in particular.
In your chapter on Frank Carlucci, you also go into the history of Richard Armitage. Now, he was part, I remember, of the George W. Bush administration. What can you tell us about Armitage?
Yes, Armitage is He was the Deputy Secretary of State on 9/11, so he was in a very powerful position with regard to people coming in and out of the country at that time. And he had developed, along with his subordinate Grant Green, a Visa Express program that a number of the alleged 9/11 hijackers supposedly took advantage of. So basically, this Visa Express program was one by which people didn't even have to come into the office in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to apply for their visa. They basically just filled out the paperwork, and a lot of these people got visas, or were told they got visas, through that office and that program. So here's Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, in charge of providing visas basically to these alleged attackers. But the history of Armitage is very strongly indicative that he is another covert operative, and he was responsible for doing drug trafficking, profiting from drug trafficking in Vietnam, and he was allegedly part of the Phoenix program, which was an assassination program in Vietnam that killed over 20,000 people in terrible ways. And Armitage was also linked to Ted Shackley and the guys who were part of this private network that had been created in the 70s. So we talked about this private network being created that the CIA was having off-the-book operations conducted by other countries. But in the 80s, that actually grew. Ted Shackley was part of the CIA and then was fired by Jimmy Carter, and those people along with him that were fired in a kind of a purging of the CIA during the Carter administration developed this private network even more strongly, and Armitage seemed to be very closely associated with those people. And so he was the protege of a man named Eric von Marbod, who was very closely linked to Shackley in the Sears World Trade Network that Frank Carlucci was running. So this appeared to be the group that was behind the Iran-Contra crimes and arms sales to Iran in the 1980s against U.S. law. And, you know, they also went back together to Vietnam and the Phoenix program. And so for them to have showed up on 9/11 in these positions of power is interesting, because partly because of not only the Iran-Contra crimes and so forth, but the Mujahideen was where we are told Al-Qaeda was born. The Mujahideen is the group of Afghan Arabs in the 1980s that the U.S. funded and trained. And this was during a time when Frank Carlucci was in and out of government in the Defense Department and the CIA, and Armitage was in and out of government in the 80s as well. And they were Armitage was going to Afghanistan and meeting with these Mujahideen Al-Qaeda precursors. And so for him to have been in that position of providing evidence on who was responsible for the crimes of 9/11 and also to have been so intimately linked to the funding and training of the Mujahideen seems like a surprising coincidence. Richard Armitage was also present on the secure video teleconference on 9/11 that Richard Clark was running from the White House Situation Room. So he was part of the group who failed to defend us on 9/11. He was a man who provided or who ran the program that provided visas to the alleged hijackers. He had this history of covert operations and connections to the Al-Qaeda precursor group Mujahideen. He really is very strongly suggestive of somebody who knew a lot more about what was going on, just like Senator Max Cleland, who quit the 9/11 commission, claimed. He claimed that the commission was a sham, that the government knew a lot more about this whole Al-Qaeda group long before 9/11 and were not being honest about it.
I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 1. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. The crimes of 9/11 are the origins of the war on terror. Which individuals and what corporate entities benefited most from the crime of 9/11?
Well, the Carlyle Group's a great example. They're a defense company that made a lot of money off of 9/11 and then bought up a lot of interesting types of companies after that. But also SAIC, as I mentioned, Science Applications International Corporation, and a couple of journalists have made it clear that SAIC, you know, more than anyone, more than any company, appears to have really made a bundle off of 9/11. These journalists, Donald Bartlett and James Steele, for example, said they're, you know, 9/11 was a personal tragedy for thousands of families and a national tragedy for all of America, but it was very, very good for SAIC. And the reason for that is that SAIC paradoxically built the systems that supposedly were to prevent terrorism. In the databases, for example, the national criminal databases where people would check for terrorists were built by SAIC. And then after 9/11, they were given huge contracts to repair those programs and to build new ones. And what they ended up doing was basically taking the money and building products that didn't work at all. And I go into that in the book to a little degree, but mostly with SAIC. What I'm trying to show is just the enormous number of contacts or connections to the crimes of 9/11 and to the possible explanations for what might have happened. So I mentioned that the company created the national databases that tracked and identified alleged terrorists. They also supplied airports with terrorism screening equipment. They actually even predicted and then investigated terrorist attacks like those that occurred in the World Trade Center. So they did investigations. Not only did they help with the NIST investigation of the World Trade Center after 9/11, but they investigated the World Trade Center event in 1993. And they had in 1986, that company had gone in and predicted basically the exact thing that happened in 1993. You know, they came, they played a big role in capturing the alleged architect of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They hired and were the employer of a man who was cleaning up Ground Zero with robots, basically using equipment that had previously been used for eliminating unexploded ordnance. His name was John Blitch. Lieutenant Colonel John Blitch left his job and joined SAIC the day before 9/11 and then spent his time cleaning up Ground Zero. So SAIC is not only profiting enormously from 9/11, but they were very intimately linked to a lot of aspects of the crimes, and they appear to be in position to help affect the crimes.
Kevin, you mentioned Richard Clark. Now, Richard Clark was a very major player among the other 19. Could you talk about who Richard Clark is, what his background is, his involvement with BCCI, the terrorist funding network, his relationship with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, his relationship with the CIA. And as an aside, I found it quite interesting that Rolling Stone journalist Michael Hastings, dying in a fiery car crash in Los Angeles at 4 a.m., a very suspicious accident, it was Richard Clark who very recently came out publicly and stated that Michael Hastings, this journalist, that this accident was consistent with a cyber attack on his car, meaning that his car could have been remotely controlled. So Richard Clark is still very much among us, and I thought it was curious that he would come out with these remarks.
Yeah, he is definitely a very interesting person, and the man is a powerful figure without question. He has been part of U.S. government for many, many years, going back, as I said, to the Ford administration, and he has worked with many of the people who are suspected of having been part of the crimes and are suspects in this book, including Paul Wolfowitz and Duane Andrews. And George Tenet was a very close friend of his, and Richard Armitage. So Dick Clark, or Richard Clark, is a man who was the counterterrorism czar, or so-called lead counterterrorism principal in the United States government from 1992. He was put in that position by George H.W. Bush in 1992. Through the events of 9/11, he was this lead counterterrorism expert. And you know, some of the things that really jump out about Clark and his background are that, you know, he was basically, he still is very close to the government of the United Arab Emirates. And why that's important is that the government of the UAE are the owners of BCCI. They helped start BCCI, and then when the Bank of England closed BCCI down in 1991, the UAE bought up all of that network. And it was shortly after that that Richard Clark started going there and essentially acting as a representative of the UAE. Now, if people have studied the 9/11 Commission report, they may find that interesting, that the lead counterterrorism expert in the United States was so close to the UAE because, well, two of the alleged hijackers came from the UAE, but all of them traveled to the United States, almost all of them, but one or two traveled to the United States for the 9/11 attacks by traveling through the UAE. Most of the funding that officially was said to have supported the alleged hijackers came from the UAE. And so why Richard Clark might have been so closely associated with this government and almost acting as a representative for them is just a startling question. The 9/11 Commission did not cover that, neither did the Congressional Joint Inquiry. But one thing they did cover, and is in the book, is that Richard Clark actually obstructed two CIA attempts to capture Osama bin Laden. And, Clark was actually questioned by Congressman Richard Burr as part of the joint inquiry about his actions to notify the UAE, to give them a heads up so that bin Laden could get, basically, ultimately, bin Laden could get away. And Clark's response to Congressman Burr was essentially an admission. He said, he thinks that those facts are slightly wrong, but basically he did brief the UAE that the CIA was watching this camp where Osama bin Laden was at, and he voted down in the previous attempt to capture Osama bin Laden. So there are other things that make Clark really suspicious, but when we know that this guy was involved with essentially helping Osama bin Laden get off the hook, as if we didn't really want to catch Osama bin Laden, or Clark didn't, that comes to mind as very serious series of questions that maybe Clark could answer for us. And I've got those questions in the book that I'm hoping that that someday Clark will be asked under oath, because he wasn't under oath he was the only one in the joint inquiry session that wasn't asked to be under oath when he admitted basically that he helped OBL off in those instances. So I've got a bunch of questions for him related to COG, you know, his continuity of government plan, how his friends in the UAE used the BCCI terrorist network, how he could have predicted, he basically predicted the 9/11 attacks in so many words. why he voted down these plans, why he didn't follow up on actions when he was given evidence that certain terrorist cells were operating in the United States. He's just been really evasive in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure how to explain his comments about Michael Hastings, but I would just say that take anything that Richard Clark says with a grain of salt.
Now, Richard Clark was the terrorism czar under Bill Clinton, so he has worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations, as have a lot of these guys. But what I was really startled to read about in your book is that it was Richard Clark who first came up with the idea of rendition or torture. Could you talk about his origination of the concept of rendition? And also, you do write a little bit about the Rwandan genocide in 1994 and how Richard Clark could have done something about that and didn't.
Yes, absolutely. As I said, Clark actually worked originally for George H.W. Bush and then for Clinton throughout the Clinton administration and then for George W. Bush as well. But in 1993 is when the U.S. began this practice known as rendition, which most people in the rest of the world would call torture. It's basically a capturing people and torturing them. And torture doesn't work well for gaining information, but Clark apparently was behind that policy. He proposed it, and it is the precursor. It was the precursor to the secret CIA rendition program that has occurred since 9/11. Clark was also criticized heavily by people who were trying to prevent the 1994 Rwandan genocide. And people who were trying to stop that slaughter before it happened said that Clark was a malicious, heartless man who was oblivious to the evidence of this genocide. And he failed to take action when there were many things the U.S. could have done to prevent the tragedy. These people said that it was Richard Clark who actually prevented the U.S. from taking any action and ultimately supporting a U.N. intervention in Rwanda. And, you know, he was very skeptical, apparently, and he was stonewalling. And that led ultimately to the genocide in which 800,000 people were killed in just 100 days in that small African country.
Kevin, how long did it take you to write this book, Another 19? It's so dense, it must have taken a very long time.
Well, you know, I've been studying the events of 9/11 for 10 years now, and I spent the first 6 years of that time focusing primarily on the World Trade Center and scientific work related to that, evaluation of the government's reports, which took a long time to produce and were very detailed. And so the first 6 years I focused on that. And in 2009, I really started looking at who might have been responsible for 9/11. So this book is a culmination of the last 4 years of research in which I'm trying to answer specific questions about what happened and what has not been explained. So about 4 years worth of work. It is a very dense book, and there's a lot of information. But if you're interested in finding out what really happened on 9/11, I believe that you'll find it useful.
Kevin Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly
clear. There's a man with a gun over there. I've been speaking with Kevin Ryan. Today's show has been Another 19, Part 1. Kevin Ryan earned a B.S. in chemistry from Indiana University and has worked as a chemistry laboratory manager for many years in Bloomington, Indiana. He is the former site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories in South Bend, Indiana, a division of Underwriters Laboratories, or UL. Kevin Ryan is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which publishes peer-reviewed research, and a founding member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. He has co-authored several books and peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject. Visit www.journalof911studies.com. That's Journal of the numbers 911studies.com. Many of his articles can be found at www.ultruth.com. That's ultruth.com. His new book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, can be found at www.another19.com. That's another, the numbers 19.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yarrow Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com or faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.org.
Say it's time that we live in jeans, and our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a video on America that is either wildly extreme or perfectly true. Plus a few thoughts from me on yet another national election from hell. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's 4 months before the national elections. I guess I'm somewhat pleased with the political opinions I see all around me, expressed by my fellow citizens. That is, nobody I know is showing any enthusiasm for either of the two major party candidates. The mood all around seems to be somewhere between resignation and depression. Here's something that struck me. Car bumper stickers and signs on people's lawns supporting a candidate are very few, far fewer than when Bernie Sanders was in the race. I think I've seen only one lawn sign supporting Clinton, maybe 10 or 12 supporting Trump. That's a low count in this area, particularly on the Democratic Party side. To the citizens' great credit, nobody is claiming anymore that a woman in the White House will produce kindler, gentler national policies, that a woman would curtail U.S. military aggression, promote more spending on education and social welfare, and bring more empathy and nurturing to our national life. People used to talk like this decades ago. Now I don't hear anybody rattling off such nonsense. That's an encouraging step towards sanity. For this growth, I guess we can thank the several high-ranking female government officials we have recently suffered under, all of them warmongers and defenders of the oligarchy. The list includes UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, US Secretaries of State Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice, and, of course, Hillary Clinton. If there is a drop of the milk of human kindness in the lot of them, they've kept it well hidden. I'm not saying that they were worse than their male counterparts, just every bit as bad. But let's get back to the positive side. The fact that even the local Democrats don't seem to want Hillary Clinton, and the local Republicans don't seem to care much for Donald Trump, that's encouraging. A sign that, at long last, Americans are becoming halfway able to tell BS from shinola. A sign that we're realizing that the system is rigged. Everybody knows the dice are loaded, to quote Leonard Cohen. Everybody knows the good guys lost. And we're playing on a cloth untrue, with a crooked cue and elliptical billiard balls. I know that should be ellipsoidal billiard balls, not elliptical. Geometry aside, that's democracy in America for you. The citizens are playing on a cloth untrue with a crooked cue and elliptical billiard balls. But enough gloom and doom from me. Here's the soundtrack from a video I stumbled across several months back. It's basically a speech about the false myth of American exceptionalism. It's about our de facto rule by financial and corporate oligarchs. It's about futile warmongering abroad, coupled with financial fraud and increasing repression at home. The narrator's style and his doomsday tone of voice make the talk sound like a typical right-wing screed. I was expecting it to tell me that all the problems of the world are caused by the Bilderberg Group, Skull and Bones, the United Nations, and the Masonic Order, all led by the Pope of Rome. But I was wrong. It's not a right-wing screed. It's a left-wing screed. The culprits it identifies are Wall Street, corrupt government, capitalist fat cats, and the military-industrial complex. Despite the extreme-sounding tone of voice and the dramatic sound effects, I had the darndest time finding any statement that I actually disagreed with. Well, what do you think? Is this tinfoil hat wacko extremism, or is it actually shrewd, sober analysis? It's produced by Class War Films, and it's titled, after Thoreau, Let Your Life Be a Friction to Stop the Machine. Here it is.
For 200 years, Americans have been indoctrinated with a mythology created, imposed, and sustained by a manipulating cabal, a financial elite that built its absolute control on the muscle and blood, ignorance, and credulity of its citizenry. It has now metastasized into the corporate tyranny that owns and controls America. America began with the invasion of a populated continent and the genocide of its people. Once entrenched, it embraced enslavement of another race. With those pillars of state in place, it declared itself an independent nation in a testament that proclaimed the equality of all mankind. In that monumental act of hypocrisy, America's myth had its genesis. A constitution was written that came to be regarded as holy writ. Designed by men of wealth and prominence, its central purposes were to defend private property and suppress mass democracy. It has fulfilled those mandates beyond the dreams of its creators. With the existing oligarchy secure in law and native people largely exterminated, the ruling class increased its wealth and power fantastically in the 19th century, using the government as its enabler, exploiting to the limit the device of chartered corporations. So empowered, the financial elite used the military to expand its sway beyond the continent. Regions, territories, islands, and whole countries were annexed, invaded, and possessed outright, their peoples crushed, suppressed, and exploited. Because ordinary Americans, like any people, need to believe that whatever the ruling class undertakes in their name must be essentially benevolent, noble in purpose, and justified in fact, the American myth had to be radically modified for imperial expansion. The foundational myth was that the Americans had come to a howling wilderness teeming with godless savages, and through invincible strength of character and purity of purpose had tamed the land and honorably earned the right to possess their bountiful home. In the era of extraterritorial expansion, that version was polished to justify and ennoble imperialism. The new corollary was that America was obliged by our manifest destiny to carry our mission into barbaric darkness wherever tyranny created abuse and suffering. A national myth that absolutely binds the loyalty of a people to its government must be a subtle and powerful elixir that elevates and aggrandizes that people's self-regard. National policy will then appear to be an extension of its superior citizenry's inchoate will and an instrument of justified arrogance toward the lesser world. The simple, powerful myth of America's heroic and altruistic benevolence, shaped by the financial elite, infused Americans with a hubristic belief in their racial superiority that mobilized gave imperialist enterprises the character of a quasi-religious crusade. In this way, insatiable imperialism acquired the apparent moral perfection of a syllogism. With World War II, the world was reconfigured. American capitalism emerged supreme from the horror that had virtually wrecked its capitalist partners. The Soviet Union, though, in spite of having absorbed much the greatest devastation of all from Nazi Germany, rose astonishingly from its ruin to become the sole rival to America as a world power. This challenge was not competitive, it was systemic. Soviet communism was a direct threat to American hegemony in that it categorically refuted the philosophical basis of predatory capitalism. Grounded in Marx and Lenin, It attacked capitalism's inherent evils, monstrous inequities, and flagrant injustices that, when exacerbated by speculation, exploitation, and fraud, would eventually destroy it. And it promoted world revolution to that end. The Cold War required further refinement of the American myth. Instead of simply intervening where circumstances supposedly demanded that we impose our system, America now had to be the shield and bulwark of the sacred capitalist system in which free enterprise, magically identified with democracy, was equally to be defended. This version held through many surrogate confrontations in the era of mutually assured destruction, and survived even the debacle of Vietnam, lasting until the collapse of the Soviet Union. On radio and television, Americans were subjected to an unrelenting barrage of hyper-patriotism, in which American moral superiority was a given, and America's self-touted courage, generosity, and decency were its unchallengeable proofs. The implosion of the Soviet Union left America, in its own terms, the sole superpower in a unipolar world, which required further retooling of the myth. The practical effect of having no doomsday enemy, China wouldn't do yet, was to supercharge its element of pure hubristic ego. America was no longer just the defender of the free world from heresy. It was now, by virtue of its glorious self-touted exceptionalism, required to oversee and police it in the interests and for the benefit of all. Power tends to corrupt, said Lord Acton. An absolute power corrupts absolutely. When the only rival to American power disintegrated, our ruling elite saw the opportunity, for the first time in history, for one country to absolutely dominate and control the world. This consensus was expressed in a policy statement by major hard right-wing political players titled The Project for a New American Century. This triumphalist manifesto laid out a plan for absolute American access to and control of essential resources and raw materials worldwide, guaranteed by our military enforcing full-spectrum dominance. The American myth, which had lost some momentum in the totally unexpected so-called Cold War victory, was now re-energized with a proactive essence, and endowed with the glowing radiance of a true and, for the first time, self-professed imperial mission. The attack on the towers, an unimaginable provocation, was the trigger mechanism for the explosive launch of the effort to impose that imperial model in practice on the world. It has been, without question, the most spectacular failure in the history of American misadventure. After a decade marked by the waste of trillions of dollars and thousands of American lives, the stunning bankruptcy of our internally burglarized nation, and a consequent recession more fundamentally damaging than the Great One, Imperial America has nothing to show for the astonishing folly of its arrogant overreach, but unequivocal disasters in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, with no end of madness in sight. It is clear that the hypnotic hold of the American myth on the loyalty of the people has led only to disgrace and tragedy, and set a course to inevitable imperial decline and ruin. This truth, though, entirely mistakes the purpose of the myth. It was never intended to serve either our country or our people. It was created solely to shield, buttress, and exalt the financial ruling class. It has done that with complete and astonishing success. As a prime example, the massive looting of funding for the Iraq-Afghanistan-Pakistan wars to enrich the corporate tyranny is on a unique scale of its own, without anything remotely comparable to its flagrant obscenity in the whole long history of war. Neither the Pentagon nor the government can account for the billions of dollars that have vanished there. There is no doubt that beyond the outrageously inflated no-bid contracts given to giant corporations with their obscene guaranteed profits, much of the money was simply stolen by, through, or in spite of the military, and distributed among thieves and accomplices. Much of it came in bricks on huge pallets, for convenience, presumably. As this wholesale corporate robbery was in progress under military oversight abroad, the corporate tyranny evolved a new set of impenetrably complex devices for the generation of money without either any economically productive source or result at home. The sole driving force and purpose of capitalism is, of course, the realization of profit. According to that iron calculus, reducing production costs increases profit margin. This leads to the obvious conclusion that as production costs near zero, profit is maximized. There is no provision for social good in capitalist theory. Corporations, created to optimize commercial opportunity through efficient specialization, were originally required to operate for public good, but that provision was quickly finessed and forgotten. American law courts have always favored corporate concentrations of wealth since they, like the Congress, exist to serve moneyed interests. And the judiciary has consistently cooperated in ruling reliably for corporations and against the interests of the people. Indeed, without considering the question in law, the Supreme Court long ago endowed corporations with personhood, that is, with all the rights of human beings under our Constitution. That this travesty occurred as a slipshod clerical error shows that the court preferred to mask this perversion of the intent of the 14th Amendment as an unexamined assumption, rather than risk an eventual test which would have created public outrage. Given the collusion of Congress and the courts in securing legal invulnerability for the corporate tyranny, and the fact that corporations' only duty is maximization of profit, it was inevitable that megabanks, huge brokerage houses, giant insurance conglomerates, gilded hedge funds, and credit agencies pretending to certify their work all engaged in massive criminal fraud and deception for just that purpose. The result was the crash of 08, the recession, and the unprecedented bailout of the biggest banks and investment houses with taxpayer dollars. So much for the invisible hand of the free market. In recent years, two related trends have battered the American myth. First, any belief the world had in it has been shattered by a catastrophic series of imbecile military disasters which has eroded its efficacy at home. Second, in response, the state has made crude efforts to boost its waning power by imposing totalitarian-style surveillance, intimidation, and coercion on the American people to a degree unprecedented in scope and scale. The vast, clanking, medieval apparatus of homeland security that has sprouted like an enormous poison fungus since 9/11, with its brutal police state mindset, the odious Patriot Act with its flagrant subversions of the Bill of Rights, the endless, fantasy-based terror peddling of the prostitute corporate media with its clowns and harpies churning irrational fear and anger in the uninformed, all this grim repressive machinery is a ham-handed attempt to distract Americans from the real causes of their injury, abuse, and oppression. And yet, even with the American myth now exposed for the tissue of lies, deceptions, and frauds that it has always been, it still keeps its phenomenal hold on the great mass of American people. The sad reality is that for the majority, their own identities have been so deeply and thoroughly infused with the myth that to disbelieve it is to disbelieve in themselves. So the dead American myth lives on in its deadness, horribly masking our crapshot economy, our bankrupt debtors' prison of a society, our ghost dance charade of kabuki democracy, while typhoons of impending social, economical, and ecological disaster build their enormous, lightning-charged thunderheads above the dark future before us. And what does the dead myth still obscure? What is beyond the wall of failing deception and dishonesty? What horrors has the shoddy fable so long and effectively concealed? It is a world brutalized by the violence of our imperialist mania. It is the wrecked and pillaged economies looted by our predatory capitalist austerity regimes. It is the hundreds of millions of starved, dying children sacrificed to Wall Street commodities gaming. It is the multitudes of innocent, ignorant people barely surviving under absolutist regimes propped up by our tax dollars, while our banks siphon off profits from arming their brutal police states and bribing their kings, sheikhs, or generals. It is the millions of dead and maimed and raped populations of simple tribal people that our indiscriminately murderous juggernaut has left in its bloody wake in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. It is the bitter and appalling legacy of hate and repulsion, disdain and fear, which America has earned with its hegemonous villainy in every region of the world. And at home, what is it we Americans have been so complicit in hiding from ourselves, in our devotion to the perverse legend that has come to inhabit our souls like an incubus? It is millions of us with no work or hope in middle age whose jobs and homes have been devoured by the sick fraud machine of Wall Street. It is the trash, demolished weed lots of our major cities crumbling in fire-gutted ruin. It is the many cities with industries defunct and factories dismantled and shipped overseas. It is our decaying, defunded public schools, our bankrupt states and counties, our overtaxed, antiquated public transportation systems, our obsolete, dissolving infrastructure, our gigantic and irrational prisons horror, our cynical healthcare con game, and over it all, the jackboot mechanism of our police state, armed and empowered, ready for use against us all. This is where we are. The great question now is whether we can awaken from our long nightmare and face the terrifying and exhilarating prospect of living in reality without the false props and dishonest constructs of a hoodwinked and dishonored people, or whether we have internalized the falsity to such an extent that it has become a collective insanity. In 1846, Henry David Thoreau, offended to his soul by the American invasion of Mexico, protested and went to jail. In his essay on civil disobedience, he said this of state policy: "If injustice is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine." To attempt to break the death grip of the American myth will be a titanic challenge. To even begin to rebel against the might of the national security state will require the courage to face far more than official disapproval. Imperial America will respond to even the most peaceful and orderly protest with hard police action, and the level of repression will rise with the scope and seriousness of the action undertaken. Small protests will have no effect. Organized mass demonstrations will draw the brutally motivated national security state apparatus down upon them. Americans, excepting our underclass, have no experience with violent police or military repression. Those who commit peaceful civil disobedience will swiftly find to their cost how it works. In a national security state that has eradicated all laws that prevent abuse of the public, whatever the state does is legal. To such a pass have we in America come, as a result of our long historic indoctrination and abject submission to our ruling class. To achieve any redemption for Americans, to make possible any more just, humane, and life-honoring society, will require complete abandonment of the system of predatory capitalism. It offers no prospect of reform or improvement, and we have all been witness to the absurdly corrupt idiocy of our so-called democratic process for generations. America is nearing the greatest crisis point in its history, and the terrific coming cataclysm will determine the future of our country. If we cannot rise in dominating numbers to reject the heartless, mindless, soulless machine of imperial predatory capitalism, we will be condemned to a fascistic command and control horror in which human beings are mere possessions of the state, units of production or service, and then perhaps not even that, as excess population in that brave new world may simply be eliminated. That end is not inevitable. We are not lost. We are not defeated, since to this moment we have not engaged. We have not honored our responsibility as human beings. We have not defended our humanity. We have abjured our power and let ourselves be ruled. All around the world, the rolling thunder of irresistible outrage is now heard and felt. In Egypt and Spain, Syria and Greece, Iraq and Sudan, Afghanistan and Ireland, everywhere the legitimate anger of humanity is fueling an uprising against the dead hand of predatory capitalism and its evils. And in Americans, so long trapped, encapsulated like flies in amber in a false religion of state idolatry, the anger is deep, widespread, and growing. The myth is broken and dead. It is up to those who know and care to lead. Thomas Paine said, "These are the times that try men's souls." Nothing is guaranteed us. That can't matter. We cannot consider odds or outcomes. We simply cannot let the machine of injustice grind on. We must confront with calm courage a vicious, tyrannical system that is destroying the earth and its life and its people. We must put our lives on the line to oppose it. And we must do it now. The nightmare machine of rapacious exploitation has overthrown decency and reason, and its bloody human treason flourishes over us. This must be ended. We must end it. Let your life be a friction to stop the machine.
We heard most of Let Your Life Be a Friction to Stop the Machine, an interesting video from Class War Films. To me, the tone of the piece sounds halfway between Doomsday and Armageddon, but darned if I can find a sentence that I think is wrong. Maybe that's why I find the presidential election depressing and irrelevant. A diversion from our real problems, not a way of solving any of them. I want to vote for the peace candidate, the candidate who says that neoliberal free market capitalism is running amok and must be reined in, the candidate who says that we've got to halt global warming, even if it does make the stock market decline a few points. I want to vote for the candidate who says, let's make America less of an oligarchy and more of a democracy. I could toss a few more planks onto this platform, but you get the gist. And that's who I will vote for, even if I have to write in the name. Well, that's the news from Darkest Connecticut. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. If you'd like to listen some more, you'll find an archive of our shows on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust, bidding you illegitimi non carborundum. Please come back again next week, and remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear a speaker from the May 2016 Left Forum panel, a group of us organized, called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. And before getting into this, for those of you who don't understand what a Global Gladio Agenda means, it refers to the NATO-CIA-run Operation Gladio that terrorized Europe from the 1950s through the 1980s. I'm going to read from an article called 53 Admitted False Flag Attacks from Washington's blog posted in February of 2015 to explain Operation Gladio. And here goes. There are many documented false flag attacks where a government carries out a terror attack and then falsely blames its enemy for political purposes. And then later in the article, it goes on to say, the former Italian prime minister, an Italian judge, and the former head of Italian counterintelligence admit that NATO, with the help of the Pentagon and CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries in the 1950s and blamed the communists in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe in their fight against communism. As one participant in this formerly secret program stated, quote, you had to attack civilians, people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. They also allegedly carried out terror attacks in France, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Greece, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, and UK. And other countries. False flag attacks carried out pursuant to this program include, by way of example only, the murder of the Turkish prime minister in 1960, bombings in Portugal in 1966, the Piazza Fontana massacre in Italy in 1969, terror attacks in Turkey in 1971, the Peteano bombing in Italy in 1972, shootings in Brescia, Italy, and a bombing on an Italian train, 1974, shootings in Istanbul, Turkey, 1977, the Atocha massacre in Madrid, Spain, 1977, the abduction and murder of the Italian prime minister, 1978, the bombing of the Bologna railway station in Italy, 1980, and shooting and killing 28 shoppers in Brabant County, Belgium, in 1985. If you want more information on Operation Gladio, you can do an online search for articles, books, and videos. There's a lot out there on it. Believe me, I'm not making it up. And if you've been paying attention, you also know that 9/11 was a false flag event, falsely blamed on Muslims, used to justify all of the wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan. But now let's get back to the Left Forum, and the speaker you're going to hear today is Richard Dolan. I want to apologize in advance for some of the sound quality. This was taped live, so some of the imperfections were unavoidable. This segment starts out with me introducing Richard Dolan. So here goes.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. This is our fifth panel on the deep state, and it is called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. Just let me give you the definition of the deep state is an unelected, unaccountable, militarized corporate security state unaffected by public opinion or elections and beyond the law's reach. We are really fortunate today to have a great panel here with us. It's an honor to be up here with them. They're going to be talking about false flags, as you know, And a false flag are what our deep state does to move their agenda forward and get the public to go along with the horrendous things that they do. We're going to start with Richard Dolan. Richard Dolan is an author and historian. His soon-to-be-published book, A History of False Flag Operations, details how clandestine agencies secretly engage in violence and destruction in order to promote their agendas. He has published 4 prior books and numerous articles on anomalous phenomena, suppressed science, secret space programs, breakaway civilizations, the intelligence community, and similar subjects. He's best known as the author of 2 volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. So if you please welcome Richard Dolan.
Thank you. Appreciate the welcome. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, I write books about the fringe. I've been doing that for a couple of decades and been the most fascinating journey of my life. I've been focusing now on false flag phenomena operations for the past year and a half. I am in the process of completing a book, hopefully before this year is out. So I guess what I would start is saying, when we look around in our society, I think it's not just those of us here who are very awake and very alert to what's happening in the world around us, but those in our family, friends, people who are not even as focused on zeroing in on the problems of this world. In my town, I live in Rochester, New York. I've seen the evaporation of Eastman Kodak in the last 20 years. It just goes poof. And you see this sense of helplessness that is really pervasive in our society. I believe, you know, in earlier years, I might have thought, well, that's just how things are. But I think this is actually by design. I think that a sense of helplessness is being imposed upon us for very specific reasons. And reason number one is that we're witnessing a theft of our planet. It's happening before our very eyes. We now know the wealthiest 80 people in the world have as much wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. The 80 wealthy, no, it's actually 60. Pardon me, that number has been recently revised. The top 60 wealthiest individuals on planet Earth have as much accumulated wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. So when you have a situation like that, and when these people, are, of course, are ensconced in the transnational corporations that dominate everything, that's theft, that's a war. If you have a war like this, the necessary thing for them to do is to rule by or war you by indirection and deception. Because what they don't want us to know is that this whole thing is happening, because then we would maybe have something to do about it. So they require compliance, first and foremost, and they require distraction and deception. Now, a false flag, the way that I've been looking at it lately, is one form, really the nastiest form, but one form of a kind of spectrum of propaganda that is used against us. All right. Some of these forms of propaganda are much more, I don't want to say benign, but much less intense. You know, we start off with the inculcation of just basic cultural values. We go to elementary school and we place our hand over our heart and we pledge allegiance to the flag, and that makes us good citizens. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want a certain level of cultural consensus, but it starts the process of working with the system, be a team player. The next level of control or propaganda is a little bit more nasty. And that's, I guess, what we call the cultural distractions, the Kardashians, you know, dancing with whatever they got on this week, Monday Night Football. And all of this that basically says to us, look over here at this pretty little thing. Don't look over here at the theft that's going on before your eyes. Have fun. Dance with the stars. And so it's increasingly, as we all can see this, an immersive culture that it's a form of brainwashing and distraction. Clearly. Now, there are always those people in our society who want to feel like they're being informed, and so they'll turn on the TV and watch CNN, in which they will then become permanently, forever distracted and confused. And again, this is by design. I used to, you know, I travel a lot, and it's really true. Like in every single airport gate in the country, virtually every airport gate in the country, if you look at the TV screen, you see CNN. And why is this? Is it really a case of every airport manager says, well, I really love CNN, I want to inform the public? Not really. What it is they have a private corporation owned by Time Warner that's kind of a great deal with the government, and they're able to do it because they are the propaganda voice of the U.S. State Department and CIA. That is what CNN is. So people will turn on the TV, they'll watch CNN, or they'll turn on their establishment news media. And there was a study done, I think, a little over 25 years ago, around the time of the Persian Gulf War, was during that time, I think out of the University of Colorado. And basically the study was, it's like, oh my God, shock. The more television news people watched, the less they knew about basic geographical facts, like where is Israel on the map? Where is Syria? Where is Russia? And they thought, well, this is a great failing of our news media, but really this is a great success of our television news culture. Right? Really, the purpose isn't to inform, it's really to pull you in for advertising and to distract you. So the whole CNN phenomenon, the MSNBC or Fox or NPR, it really doesn't matter. It literally does not matter. So that whole purpose is to exist within a very narrowly defined spectrum of what is permissible social discourse. And within those boundaries, you must remain. Beyond those boundaries, do not dare to go, or else become shamed and you're out of the discussion. So I would say that those three levels of propaganda probably account for 95% of all of the mind control that exists in our society, and it works very well. But then you have an occasional necessity, let us say, in the minds of those who are wanting to handle us, for stronger measures. And this is when we get into various types of covert operations, whether it's color revolution, regime change, other types of what I'd like to call shock doctrine, opportunism, after the excellent book by Naomi Klein, and then into false flags. So I'll just talk a little bit about those. So again, I look at these all as a spectrum. And it seems to me it's helpful for us to see how false flags fit into this spectrum. And by the way, what I will then conclude with is, because I don't really want to get into the specific false flags. These gentlemen will talk about some of them. There's probably 100. In the book that I'm working on, I think I've identified probably about 100 or so likely false flag events that have shaped our world in the last century. But what I'm more interested in going over here with you today is simply giving a kind of, at least my analytical framework and why I think that this is something that we really need to understand. But when we get into color revolutions, a stronger medicine, as it were, to control us and corral us, these are things really that begin to an argument with your relatives or with some debunker or skeptic on the news bulletin boards. One thing you can tell them is that false flags are in the U.S. Army Psychological Operations Manual. It's right in there. It's in the book. What they now call psychological operations, they don't call them PSYOPs anymore. They call them Military Information Support Operations, or MISO, MISO. So in this manual, they define white, gray, and black operation, black PSYOPs. So white PSYOPs are pretty straightforward. It's basically the U.S. State Department putting out a statement on behalf of the United States government. You know where it's coming from. They're obviously spinning their information, but it's fairly straightforward. That's a white PSYOP. Gray PSYOP is a little different. If you know, many of us are familiar with Operation Mockingbird, that was a gray PSYOP. So it was a situation in which you have proxies in the media basically doing your speaking for you. It's a great thing. If you're doing public speaking and you seed the audience with your cohorts who then pitch you softball questions and make you look smart, that would be a gray PSYOP, I guess you could say. In the U.S. military's formulation of it, a gray PSYOP would be statements by other sources, presumably media sources or NGOs would also be one, that would actually be providing your perspective on things. But it makes it look much more impressive because it's not you saying it, so that's a gray PSYOP. And that was Operation Mockingbird, which Carl Bernstein outed back in 1977, in which we learned that there were at least, I think it's very understated, 400 paid U.S. journalists on the CIA payroll back then. Of course, as we know, the CIA then said, oh, no, we don't do that arrangement with journalists anymore. Very legalistic terminology if you really hear the CIA talk like this. Obviously, what we have today is a situation so vastly beyond anything that ever existed in the Mockingbird days. It's beyond the pale. Because it's not just the CIA, it's the military, it's the Pentagon, which spends $4 billion every year on managing its social media. So they're taking your money and my money and then using it to mind job you and propagandize you. Oh, that's great. Thank you. So that's a great PSYOP. Now, black PSYOP is, and actually, I wish I had the quote in front of me. It's okay. A black PSYOP in their manual is literally a situation in which agents or actors who are part of the U.S. system create an act that is then attributed to another party. It could be another country or another party. That is literally a false flag. One of the interesting things they say in this manual is that that type of activity is not something that military personnel do, that this is the reserve of intelligence, whether it's military intelligence, Army, Navy intelligence, Air Force intelligence, or CIA or some other intelligence group, but not the military. And again, this is explicitly stated in the current U.S. Military Psychological Operations Manual. I think it's rather interesting. So again, if you're in a debate with your friends or adversaries, this is part of the playbook. But there's a spectrum, as I said before. So one thing that the United States has mastered the art of is the color revolution kind of protocol. And many of us are familiar with what happened in Iran in 1953. Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of TR, helps to organize Operation Ajax, in which Mossadegh is taken out, God forbid, because he really took shell oil out of Iran and can't do that. So he's got to go. Well, after the fall of the Soviet Union, we have the perfection of the so-called peaceful revolutions, the Kolmogorov revolutions. Georgia in 03 had the Rose Revolution, Ukraine in 04 had the Orange Revolution, and so on. These are supposedly people-generated movements to get rid of authoritarian governments, which then inevitably become very, very pro-Western, pro-corporate, just so happens. Well, this is, again, by design. So we know that these are promoted and funded with billionaire money. George Soros, very much involved in this whole thing. Koch brothers are doing this right now in Brazil against Dilma Rousseff. Same type of protocol. So you have a situation in which money goes into these countries, destabilizes them, finds a wedge by which to open up the society, particularly getting young people to get worked up over a particular issue. It's easy to do. And you get them to the streets and boom, next thing you know, you're inciting revolution. And sometimes, if you're the CIA, you'll have your snipers on the rooftops like in Ukraine, killing people and attributing it to the government. So that's the color revolution protocol. And what's amazing about it is the U.S. has become so good at this. There's no one in the world can do what the U.S. does in this regard. I'm going to talk about why in like about 1 minute. Beyond color revolutions and provocations, agent provocateurs and crowds and so forth, inciting violence. This is an old story, of course. It goes on to this day. And in effect, it's spread more and more. It's global. The real difficulty in separating false flags, let me phrase it this way. There's one difficulty in identifying a false flag, and that is distinguishing it from what I call the shock doctrine opportunism. So Naomi Klein's excellent book, Shock Doctrine, and she has a very important insight. She's talking about how the U.S. runs the world militarily by shock and awe, which is really one of the most incredible expressions. Think about this. Your own government's like shocking and awing other countries. Well, she had the insight that this is not simply how we rule militarily, but how we rule at home, through trauma, through shock. So she talked about Katrina. She talked about 9/11. And she wasn't talking about them as false flags, but she was talking about them as traumatic events in which people are bereft. They're kind of on their back psychologically, and they're looking to the government for help. And it's at that moment she points out that these plans roll out, corporate takeover of New Orleans after Katrina, national security protocols after 9/11, the whole USA Patriot Act fascist takeover. So all of these are, I guess she would see, I don't want to misquote her, but as a kind of evil opportunism. I think this is exactly very much part of our world. But I would say there are instances in which agencies go a step further and they make these things happen. And that's a false flag. And distinguishing between opportunism and false flag, I would have to say, is probably not always going to be easy. And maybe it's not always even necessary. Because I think we're getting to a point in our world where, you know, if you really know how to ride that horse known as the public, you know when things are going to happen. And sometimes it's in your interest just to let them happen, or maybe just nudge them a little bit. So we're getting into a very, very sophisticated kind of gray area here. These handlers are very good at what they do. The reason that we have false flags permeating our world today, you know, there are people, you go on the web and they'll talk about false flags as an ancient phenomenon. And when I started looking into this, I was inclined to accept that. I don't believe that anymore. I think false flags are a distinctively modern phenomenon. There may be some ancient false flags, but they're the outliers, not the rule. Nero burning down Rome, I actually doubt it. I don't think that's what happened, blaming it on the Christians. But even if it is, it's an exception to the rule. Basically, false flags, with a few exceptions, begin in earnest after the First World War. And the reason for this is very simple. The world is militarized after the First World War, so we actually now have covert op teams that exist, which didn't exist before, at least sophisticated ones. Secondarily, we have the now birth, really, of the modern media propaganda system. And this is an absolute necessity. And we have this situation after the First World War in which certain governments particularly dominated their national media. We're talking Germany, Japan, Soviet Union, which really initiated the first real true false flags of our era in the 1930s. Don't need to get into them. They're mostly international other than the Reichstag, the Manchuria's false flag, invasion of Poland, obviously, invasion of Finland was a false flag by the Soviets. These are international. They were really early types of false flags in our modern era. What we see after the Second World War is a transformation of this phenomenon. It becomes much more domestic. So the tools are being used against populations. And in the false flag Olympics after the Second World War, the United States runs away with the gold medal. There's no question about it. And the reason for this, and I'm now going to jump ahead and wrap up why this is conceptually really so important. False flags, we had Gladio in the 50s, we had COINTELPRO, we had a lot of other things. We had the U.S. and the British funding the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1950s to take down Nasser in Egypt. They didn't like the fact that you had this independent Egyptian leader who was not going to be part of any of the blocs. And they said, well, he's got to go. So they funded the head-chopping jihadists back then. Well, it didn't work against Nasser. But hey, why stop a good thing? And they just kept it going. And they do that to this day, clearly. But the reason false flags are necessary from their point of view today is twofold. Let's go back to Seattle in 1999, all right, the WTO protests. And you have a situation in which an entire middle class of a nation is being disemboweled, which is really what we've got. When people believe they have rights, they're really not going to take that lying down. They'll protest, as they did in Seattle, when more than 40,000 people shut that entire city down. And the WTO protests, they literally prevented delegates from entering the building. Tear gas didn't work. Pepper spray didn't work. This is an unmanageable situation from the point of view of those people at the very top of our food chain. This is 18, 19 months before 9/11. So what 9/11 meant is that the hammer came down on us, beat us over the head with a big national security stick, and away goes this idea of people protest. Now, if you protest, which many of us here do, we know you're photographed, you're in a database. It's an act of intimidation at the very least, and coercion at the most. And this has now become the norm. So globalization, neoliberalist, transcorporate domination agenda, this is one of the key pillars of why false flags are necessary. There needs to be a pretext to intimidate the population. The other pillar, why false flags are necessary today is, I would say, is the petrodollar system, which is really the foundation of the U.S. empire internationally. You know, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1971 simply because the Vietnam War caused us to crank out the dollars. The U.S. was hinged to gold. The dollar suddenly was not really reflecting the price of gold accurately. Nations realized this. We started hemorrhaging gold out of Fort Knox because the dollar was really overvalued. And Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard temporarily, by which he meant permanently. And that saved the gold problem. It did not save the dollar problem. There was a danger of all these dollars coming back. There's really no intrinsic reason for nations to hold on to the dollar if there's no U.S. dollar gold standard. Enter Henry Kissinger 2 years later, makes a deal with Saudi Arabia, says, we will support your evil, tyrannical 9th century regime forever, give you all the weapons you want, as long as you sell all your oil in dollars, accepting no other currency. Saudis are cool with that. All the other OPEC nations go on board, and the U.S. is back on easy street. And the necessity, it's a horrible crime that Americans are not educated in this fundamental fact. Almost every important feature of American foreign policy has some relation to a dollar. It must be maintained. And when the threats come to the system, such as Saddam Hussein in 2000 starts selling his oil in euros, that can't happen. So we create the fictitious weapons of mass destruction charade. Muammar Gaddafi, a few years later, is about to introduce a gold-based dinar. Cannot happen. You create fictions about carpet bombing your population during the Arab Spring and so forth, and you have them killed. And, you know, they wanted to do the same thing with Syria, which wasn't a direct threat to the petrodollar system, but geopolitically is allied with those groups that do threaten the petrodollar system and has to be taken down as well. So I think what we're seeing is, as long as this situation is in place, and the other reasons we have to have false flags from their point of view is we have a situation in which we've got international law, which says wars are wrong after the First World War, and a situation in which nations are ostensibly democratic. And I say ostensibly. Almost every nation in the world now is ostensibly democratic, with very few exceptions. And so what that means is governments have to have the pretext of rule by the people. And this is why they need to corral public opinion the way that they do. All right, so it's when an international law says now war is wrong, you can't have wars of aggression and so forth. So you've got to create these pretexts. False flags are the ultimate tool in the propaganda toolkit for this. We're now in an era post 9/11 in which, you know, when you're creating a kind of global police state, and this is exactly what we're seeing, of course, you have to go by degree, step by step by step by step by step to intimidate and modify the behavior of entire populations. So each successive false flag that we see, or each successful form of manipulation we see, they're not all on the order of 9/11, of course. They don't have to be. They can be smaller false flags, but each one it's like a specialized weapon designed for a specialized goal and agenda. You know, in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, which, yes, absolutely. I think the primary focus of that was to roll out the militarized police. That is now a ubiquitous fact of American life, in which you have 19,000 militarized police breaking into the homes of Boston residents as if there's no big deal. Well, we've gone through all that now. That's part of what we are. But some of the mass shootings, sure, there's undoubtedly gun control motivations in it, but there's also psychological profiling motivations in there. Sandy Hook is a perfect case in point, where you have legislation coming out to now, let's create psychological profile screening of the population, mental health, and so forth. Last thing I'll just say is, how do we identify these? what we're seeing is almost like a cold war, a psychological cold war going on between the deep state and us. All right. So as we learn more, they adapt. So one of the things that you see with these false flags, when you see a major, horrific, traumatic event happen and an immediate media focus to identify the culprit, in which within days, everything seems to be all figured out, we really have to be very suspicious. It doesn't prove that it's a false flag. The only thing that proves a false flag is good independent journalism and investigation. But there are profiles of these. The existence of the multiple drills often is the case. I don't know if that will continue indefinitely because I think people are onto this. But you had it with 9/11. You had it with London, the two bombings, 7/7/05. You had it with some of the shootings, Aurora, Colorado, and I believe San Bernardino, and there are others in Paris as well. You have these drills going on. And what's the point of these drills? Like, drills to protect against the exact event that happens. What a coincidence. Well, I think the reason for this has happened many times, very deeply suspicious. Well, reason number one is that, you know, it's helpful in providing confusion to the day to impede proper response to the event itself. But I think the real reason is deeper in the planning stages. If I'm working on a false flag and you're in the intelligence community and you're my colleague and you're not on the on the inside of it, but you learn about this somehow in advance of it, I can simply say to you, no, no, we're doing a drill. So it would really disable an independent investigation within in the intelligence group. And I think that's actually an important part of it. But the thing is, we're learning these tricks, and now I think that we're going to see adaptations in the future. I think moving forward, we have to look for more adaptations and variations in false flags. They're not all simply going to be military events. They're not all simply going to be shootings and bombings. They're corporate. They are a variety of forms of psychological manipulation, often in a very subtle, sophisticated way. And, you know, we've moved a long, long way from the actual false flags of the pirate days. Would that we were as honorable as the pirates. You know, and when they would give you a false flag, they would literally raise the flag of another country, Britain or Netherlands, and then you'd come up to them, but then they would raise the black flag, and you know it's pirates robbing your ship. At least they had that much of a sense of honor. We're so far removed from that. The last thing I would just say is we're reminded of Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And this is true. What we have to do is not despair. We have to just wake up ourselves, wake up other people around us, and be brave. I believe that it is absolutely possible for us on an individual basis and on a social basis to organize and to fight this. It's really the only choice we have. We're moving into a global society. The real question is it going to look like freedom or is it going to look like fascism? And I think we want it to look like freedom. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to a presentation given by author Richard Dolan at the May 2016 Left Forum in New York City. The full video of the false flag panel he was part of is posted on YouTube. I encourage you to check it out. And now to close out the show, I'm going to read a few more of these false flag attacks from the article 58 admitted false flag attacks. So here goes. Japanese troops set off a small explosion on a train track in 1931 and falsely blamed it on China in order to justify an invasion of Manchuria. A major with the Nazi SS admitted at the Nuremberg trials that under orders from the chief of the Gestapo, he and some other Nazi operatives faked attacks on their own people and resources, which they blamed on the Poles to justify an invasion of Poland. The British Prime Minister admitted to his defense secretary that he and American President Dwight Eisenhower approved a plan in 1957 to carry out attacks in Syria and blame it on the Syrian government as a way to effect regime change. The NSA admitted that it lied about what really happened in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, manipulating data to make it look like North Vietnamese boats fired on a U.S. ship so as to create a false justification for the Vietnam War. A U.S. congressional committee admitted that as part of its COINTELPRO campaign, the FBI had used many provocateurs in the 1950s through 70s to carry out violent acts and falsely blame them on political activists. Senior police officials in Genoa, Italy, admitted that in July 2001 at the G8 summit in Genoa, it planted two Molotov cocktails and faked the stabbing of a police officer in order to justify a violent crackdown against protesters.
Although the FBI now admits that the 2001 anthrax attacks were carried out by one or more U.S. government scientists, a senior FBI official says that the FBI was actually told to blame the anthrax attacks on Al-Qaeda by White House officials. A former U.S. intelligence officer recently alleged, "Most terrorists are false flag terrorists or are created by our own security services." The head and special agent in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles office said that most terror attacks are committed by the CIA and FBI as false flags. So don't be duped. Whenever there's a new terrorist attack, please make sure you do your homework before you believe what the government and media are telling you. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. We turn our attention now to Mexico. There is an urgent situation facing teachers and their union, the Coordinador Nacional de Trabajadores de la Educación in Mexico. June 19th, teachers in Oaxaca were fired upon by the federal police as part of the effort by President Enrique Peña Nieto to break the nationwide strike by teachers against the government's privatizing education reform program. The peaceful demonstration was also held to demand the immediate release from prison of three top union officers. These union leaders have been jailed and sent to a federal prison more than 1,000 miles away by the government on trumped-up charges. 10 people were killed by the federal police, with dozens more wounded and 22 disappeared. Protest organizers are also demanding, supported now by labor and community activists across the United States, that the U.S. government halt the military aid to Mexico, as the teachers made available to the Mexican federal police to repress the teachers have been sent by the U.S. under the Plan Marita. So the U.S. is sending military aid for weaponry that is used by the Mexican government against the strikers. The anti-union repression against striking teachers in Mexico, following on the heels of the measures imposed by the international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank, must concern all workers and trade unions the world over. And I am delighted to have with me Laura Carlson, who is sacrificing some of her sleep to get up and speak to us about this incredibly important situation. And Laura, why don't we begin by flesh out for us the detail of the privatizing of the education reform program, in quotes, that is the promoter for the strike by the teachers' union?
Well, this is a package of neoliberal reforms that President Peña Nieto rammed through Congress at the beginning of his presidency. And in the case of education, what this reform would do is essentially, they call it privatizing because it opens up the schools to private funding for certain types of things that will deepen the inequality that already exists within the schools. For example, when schools have to rely on private funds for textbooks or for infrastructure improvements and that kind of thing, then of course the poorer communities lose more and the more wealthier communities gain, and the state abdicates its responsibilities in terms of free public education. And this is a huge problem because education is already so unequal here in Mexico. There is a real crisis in the educational system. It's failing many, many people. There are a third of the schools that don't have basic things such as running water, bathrooms, and even walls and a roof. There are classes that are being held, you know, outdoors in communities that don't even really have schools. So it's a huge problem, and it's a reform that was created not in Mexico and certainly not with consultations with the teachers themselves, who are, of course, the people who are closest to the real crisis in education within the country. It's a reform that was devised by a business group called Mexicans First and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and Cooperation. As you know, in the United States, because you've seen similar reforms there, the whole concept of it is to create public education not for human development, but to serve the changes within the labor market. And to apply a kind of a one-size-fits-all forms of measuring not education or, again, human development, but productivity in some ways and the ways in which the education sector could serve the needs of big business. These kinds of reforms, especially when they're applied in a developing country, exclude huge numbers of people and limit the horizons of students to become kind of cogs in the economy.
I wonder if you can put in context for us the incredible violence that was unleashed against the teachers. Give us more of a sense of who these teachers are within the context of the union. And again, the incredible violence that was unleashed, which some people were certainly want here to believe that there is a democracy within Mexico, but I dare say that has not been the case when it comes to the overall population and the force of the Mexican federal government.
Yeah, we were surprised, although the protests have been going on for months. Really, they've been going on for 3 years since the reform was passed against the will of the teachers, many, many of the teachers, by the violence and the direct attack of the June 19th massacre in a town in southern Mexico, the state of Oaxaca, called Nochitlán. What happened there was the teachers were protesting, and one of the common tactics has been to create road blockades and only let certain cars pass. And the federal police and what's called the gendarmerie came in, which is like a military police, came in and attacked them directly. There's evidence that they were given orders to shoot to kill. And this was a busy town square. It was market day. The protesters were there, and there were also a large number of sympathizers in the area. With the result that 10 people were killed and over 100 people were wounded, and there have been people who have been arrested as well. So it was a massive attack on the movement. Presumably, the idea was to send a message that they were no longer going to put up with these roadblocks or these protests, which, of course, is completely anti-democratic when you have such a huge sector of the people most involved and with most at stake in the educational reform, in addition to the students they teach, that are asking for major revisions in that reform. Again, this is, we have a pre-government, which is the ruling party for 71 years of authoritarian one-party rule until the year 2000. And they're back again with the Peña Nieto government. And it's not unusual for them to use these kinds of tactics when they're unable to suppress a grassroots movement by other means. So in that case, it isn't surprising, although, of course, many people, after all this talk about Mexico being in a transition to democracy, had expected a different type of behavior. So in many ways, the government itself revealed its true colors, unfortunately, in this attack. Now there's been so much public outpouring and such a huge international cry of outrage regarding this massacre that the government has been forced to the negotiating table. They're sitting down with representatives of the union. It's important to take a minute to describe this union. We're talking about the Coordinadora, as you mentioned, which is the National Association of Education Workers. And the Coordinadora is the democratic current within the huge National Union of Education Workers. They have been around for over three decades attempting to democratize the union, which has been traditionally run by union bosses with a close relationship to the ruling party. This movement has survived over all these decades, and of course it's experiencing a resurgence now by being the organization that's really concentrating and leading the resistance to this education reform that comes primarily from the teachers, their own constituencies, but has also encountered a huge level, especially if you look at states like Chiapas and Oaxaca, of support from the communities, from civil society as well.
At this point, can you also tell us something about Plan Merida? So, as we mentioned, there has been a call on people across the U.S. of progressive ilk to critique the armaments, the money for the militarization and the military might that is used against workers within Mexico. Tell us more about Plan Merida, if you can.
Well, the Merida Initiative, and also sometimes called Plan Mexico or Plan Merida, was announced by President Bush in 2007 as a way for the United States to support the war on drugs in Mexico. And it was first appropriated by Congress in 2008. It was devised as a three-year plan to dismantle the drug cartels. This was shortly after then-President Felipe Calderón announced this disastrous, we can clearly see that now, war on drugs strategy in Mexico at the very end of 2006. Since then, the United States government has sent around $3 billion worth of training, or has appropriated training and equipment to Mexico, most of it in the form of security aid to the police and to the military. This includes airplanes, helicopters, all types of military and security aid and training in places like the School of Americas, where we know that the training is heavily focused on anti-insurgency or repressive types of tactics. They've taken Mexicans to Iraq to learn the kinds of occupation tactics that were developed there. And what we've seen here is that all of this is going not even so much to fight the drug cartels, because there's been no change in the flow of illicit drugs to the United States as a result of all this effort, supposed effort. and there's been a huge increase in violence as the cartels have been entering into turf wars, and the whole situation has been destabilized by the participation of the army and with U.S. support. And mainly what all this is going toward is to repression of the people itself. So the demand to suspend the Merida Initiative has been circulating, certainly in the United States and in Mexico as well, since it was first announced. And it was clear that it was going to be a way to bolster the repressive might of an authoritarian government. And as time goes by, and especially with this latest example of the use of military and police forces against a grassroots movement in the case of the education workers, it's been very clear that that's precisely the aim and the use of this war on drugs and the USAID that's going toward it.
I wonder if you can also comment, there was a report that came through that recently there were public protests by border factory maquiladora workers in Ciudad Juarez. Do you have information on that? It would seem that the labor activism is very much on the rise, but of course so is the suppression and oppression of the workers. But what can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is recent, that there was a blockage of the international bridge from workers from several different maquiladoras. In the last year or so, we've seen an increase in protests against the conditions in the maquiladoras, the conditions of wages and working conditions themselves, which has been a real positive sign. There was a labor movement within a company called Lexmark and others, and it's a positive sign because there'd been a certain lull in worker protests for many years. And yet the conditions have continued to be terrible, particularly in terms of how low the wages are and the living and working conditions of the workers there, many of them women and young women who are supporting families. So there is an increase in the labor movement along the border. Other sectors are looking to understand that there's a number of organizations along the border that are supporting this, and we do expect that will be on the rise. And of course, in that context, we're very wary of and watching for the possibility of repression as well.
I want to move back, thank you, to the teachers. On July 9th, the report also has it that hundreds of teachers affiliated with the Resiste organization and the National Coordination of Education Workers again seized a dozen highway toll booths south of Juarez and across the state of Chihuahua as part of the intensified national movement against the 2013 education reform law. And I should say also that what we didn't mention in repudiation of the repression against teachers and their supporters, including the firings of several thousand teachers for refusing to take part in a mandatory evaluation exam. Can you tell us more about that, Laura?
Yeah, there are two things that are particularly important about this Chihuahua movement. First of all, I'll start with the last one because I didn't mention it before. The evaluation is one of the key demands for changing the education reform of the Democratic Teachers Movement. And what they're saying is we are not against evaluation. We're open to evaluation, but this particular type of standard evaluation is a violation of labor rights, and it's a type of evaluation that does not take into account the conditions in which we work. And what they're saying is that there is such a broad range of conditions within education. There are teachers who are working in the poorest communities and that are actually, you know, paying out of their own pocket for such basic things as chalk and pencils, and then there are teachers who are working in very wealthy schools with computers and such. And so to evaluate both students and teachers in with the same kind of a grid is going to be obviously prejudicial to the teachers who are working in the most difficult conditions. Also, because of the way that this is taken out of the hands of the union, there is the possibility, and we're seeing it, as you mentioned, there have been thousands of teachers who've been fired for failing to take the exam, and there's a mechanism in which many thousands of teachers could be fired for failing the exam, and none of this has any labor rights guaranteed. So the union, which has been strong, although not necessarily democratic, particularly from the rank-and-file point of view, loses almost all its power of negotiation or protection of labor rights. There's really no appeal process for these firings, and there's the potential that's very high of using these kinds of mechanisms to really purge the union of some of the most dedicated teachers and teachers that are most involved in the process of democratization and defense of public education. Now, the second point is that the state of Chihuahua is not ordinarily concerned among the strongholds of the democratic current of the teachers union. So what we're seeing right now is really the expansion of not just protests against a reform, but the construction of a democratic teachers movement in Mexico. As I say, it's been going on for a long time. It's actually held the leadership of important state unions such as Oaxaca and others for many, many years, where the CENTE, as opposed to the more official parts of the union, have been elected into the leadership. But now what we're seeing is that it's becoming stronger and far more visible and showing strong ties to society in other states as well, including Chihuahua and some of the northern states where it hadn't traditionally had the same level of representation and organization.
Laura, as we wind up, what have been the repercussions for the government of the 10 people who were killed by the federal police and the dozens wounded and, as I said, still, to our knowledge, unexplained disappearance of 22 people? Is the government on the ropes at this point?
Yeah, I think you could easily talk about a political crisis. If you look at the latest figures, President Peña Nieto's popularity or approval ratings are at an all-time low. In fact, they're really at rock bottom. Now, of course, with an authoritarian government, the representative democracy does not work because of high levels in fraud and vote buying in Mexico, and without re-election, in some ways, the PRI has never really cared all that much about its level of approval. But this does represent a political crisis. They have been forced to negotiate with the teachers. They're in that process now. There are three working groups that have been opened up on political, economic, and educational activities. And so that kind of demonstrates that there's they're scrambling to try to figure out how to respond. They tried outright repression. It had a high political cost, both an international image, which also, when you take it along with Ayotzinapa, the disappearance of the 43 students in Guerrero, and other major crises that the government has faced, or rather caused, had a huge impact on its international image. And they're also very concerned about a number of things. They're very concerned that this teachers movement has become a lightning rod, not only for protests against the educational reform, but what they have at stake is that if the teachers manage to renegotiate and even get rid of some of the most objectionable aspects of the education reform, then that could open up more popular protest against the other neoliberal reforms. All these reforms were pressed through a pre-controlled Congress and have high levels of rejection, really, among the population. When you look at the privatization of the oil sector especially, there was a lot of popular protest against this, and yet because of the control of the government itself, both the executive branch and the legislative and the legislature, they went through anyway, and the people's movements were not able to block them. If the teachers go forward with saying this isn't the demand, this isn't the education reform we want, and they have a very specific proposal for what kinds of reforms are really needed, if they go forward with that and create a broader, ever broader grassroots movement that the government's forced to respond to, they're afraid that it's going to be possible to do the same thing with some of the other reforms. This should be done. There should have been a much broader social consensus before these reforms were pushed through, and they shouldn't have pushed through such neoliberal reforms that affected public goods and public interests so gravely against the will of the majority of people. So this would be a positive thing, but of course for the government, it's being seen as a huge threat because it has both the Peña Nieto legacy and the interests of the business class riding on the success of these neoliberal reforms. Just today it came out in the paper that the business sector that's organized in the business council that's nationwide is pressing strongly to say to the government as they enter into negotiations, we are here, you know, they don't say it out loud, but we created this reform, essentially, and we are not going to allow you to back down on it. So we're seeing the sides split in quite polarized positions as we go into negotiations. The CENTE has said that they will not accept anything short of reforms to the education reform. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
And we'll keep on top of that. And thank you for your important analysis. We need to keep in touch with what is happening in Mexico, most obviously. And we have been speaking with Laura Carson in Mexico. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mimi.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I don't care what they say. I simply cannot believe that Eleanor Roosevelt is a lesbian.
The other students, at the beginning when I first transitioned, they were fine. They were way better than compared to the teachers and the staff at that school.
I committed myself to being visible and being her advocate and her ally 100%.
Doesn't matter who you love.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Australia's tight national elections squeeze marriage equality's future, a motivated mom is fearlessly raising Zoe, and pop stars raise their voices and their hands for Orlando. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending July 9th, 2016. As we first reported last week, the results of national elections in Australia have been too close to call. The future of marriage equality could hang in the balance. While nothing is firmly settled as we record this newscast, votes are still being counted. The consensus now generally seems to be that Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and his coalition government will remain in power, although by an extremely slim parliamentary margin. Marriage equality activists say that election results already suggest that there will be enough votes to pass a bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in the next parliament, if coalition MPs are allowed to vote their conscience. Equality activists have long argued against the planned non-binding national plebiscite on the issue, which Turnbull has consistently supported. But some analysts say that a narrow governing coalition majority could be fractured over the issue, as more and more Liberal Party MPs have expressed support for equality. Measures for both a marriage equality plebiscite and a conscience vote would have to pass the Senate, which seems to have a solid pro-equality majority to go forward. Opposition Labour Party leader Bill Shorten has vowed to pass marriage equality legislation within the first 100 days of his administration, which is now apparently an unlikely scenario. All told, as one news outlet concluded, the future of marriage equality in the land down under still looks murkier than ever.
Emotions at the 36th annual LGBT Pride Parade in Toronto range from celebratory to confrontational. At the head of the procession, Justin Trudeau became the first sitting Canadian Prime Minister to march in the parade. He downplayed the historic moment, however, telling local reporters that it shouldn't be a big thing that the Prime Minister is walking in the Pride Parade, and from now on, it won't. Record crowds were reported, including some 11,000 participants at an earlier trans march that organizers said made it the largest of its kind in the world. 73 drag queens and kings also made history by breaking a Guinness record for the world's largest stage show of drag artists. The previous record, established in 2014, was 55. The day-long event, called Drag On, was hosted by Lady Bunny and Bianca Del Rio from RuPaul's Drag Race. RuPaul himself gave a rabble-rousing Out of Drag Pride Day speech from the main stage.
The Pride Parade itself came to a grinding halt, however, when the group Black Lives Matter Toronto staged a sit-in, blocking the route for close to a half hour. They complained that the event was anti-black and dispersed only after organizers agreed to a series of demands, including the removal of police entries from future parades, because, a group spokesperson said, law enforcement people make members of the black and trans community feel unsafe. Pride organizers later said that no decisions about the group's demands had been made and that they only agreed to them at the time to get the parade moving again. Canadian media has been mixed at best about the Black Lives Matter action. Conservative Globe and Mail columnist Margaret Wendt called the group bullies. A Toronto Star editorial said that Black Lives Matter should think twice about making outsiders of its allies in the fight for inclusion and respect. But Joshua Ostroff, a senior editor for Huffington Post Canada, wrote that LGBT rights have progressed because of protest, and people who have benefited from those actions should look beyond themselves and consider the struggles of those still fighting, because pride is, always has been, and always will be, political.
Many pride parades around the world, including Toronto's, included an increased police presence and memorials to remember the massacre at the gay Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, that killed 49 people and injured 53. The parade in Paris, which also included marchers wearing black armbands and holding a moment of silence to honor the victims, was curtailed by police officials because of security concerns. More than 1,000 police officers were reportedly on hand, three times the number at last year's parade. And organizers postponed the annual Pride picnic in College Station, Texas, after threats of violence were posted on social media that they said police and the FBI are actively investigating. College Station, the home of Texas A&M University, sits about 90 miles northwest of Houston.
Some LGBT activists have been organizing around an additional movement goal in response to the Orlando massacre. A new group called Gays Against Guns marched in the New York City Pride Parade and held several brief die-ins to protest the National Rifle Association's stranglehold on efforts to pass even the most common-sense gun control legislation in Congress. An estimated 500 people marched in the contingent carrying signs that read, "I am Pulse" and "Flowers, Not Guns." 49 people, dressed in white garments and veils, marched silently behind them, each carrying a large photo of one of the Pulse victims with their name and age. And the Washington Blade reported the formation of a new political action committee in Washington, D.C. this week, called the Pride Fund to End Gun Violence. According to its organizers, the group wants to focus LGBT community efforts on electing lawmakers who will support meaningful gun safety legislation and defeat those who won't.
In other news, almost half of the United States are suing the Obama administration over its guidelines on transgender student access to bathrooms on federally funded school and university campuses. The guidelines call for trans students to be able to use the facility that matches their gender identity. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a motion on behalf of a coalition of other states asking for an injunction to prevent the Obama administration from enforcing the guidelines. Joining Texas were Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Maine, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Utah, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. Paxton's lawsuit challenges the premise of the Obama administration's guidelines, which say that federal civil rights laws banning bias based on sex also ban discrimination against transgender people. A second lawsuit, using similar arguments, was filed a few days later by Nebraska, in coalition with Arkansas, Kansas, Michigan, Montana, North Dakota, Ohio, South Carolina, South Dakota, and Wyoming. The Obama administration guidelines issued in May are not legally binding, although they spell out the obligations schools have to their transgender students and suggest a possible loss of federal funding for noncompliance.
But voters in Washington have rejected an effort to put an initiative on the November ballot to overturn a state regulation allowing trans people to use the bathroom of the gender with which they identify. Just Want Privacy, the organization supporting the proposed Initiative 1515, canceled a much-ballyhooed morning appointment to turn in enough qualified signatures on July 8th. According to its website, the group had collected 190,985 signatures, significantly less than the 246,372 valid signatures of registered voters required to qualify an initiative for the ballot, and far short of the 325,000 the Secretary of State's office recommends because of possible invalid or duplicate signatures. A state regulation that took effect in December requires buildings open to the public, including schools, to allow trans people to use restrooms and locker rooms that match their gender identity. At the time, the Washington Human Rights Commission said the new rule was a clarification of the state's existing anti-discrimination law that added transgender people as a protected class in 2006. Also on July 8th, Republican Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts signed a bill that will allow the Bay State's trans citizens to use the restrooms and locker rooms that correspond to their gender identity. The new law takes effect on October 1st.
And finally,
oh my!
It looks like the Star Trek universe will finally have its first openly gay character. In the upcoming Star Trek Beyond, Lieutenant Hikaru Sulu, played by John Cho, has a husband with whom he's raising a young daughter. Cho said that he likes the idea that the revelation is made matter-of-factly in the course of the story, which he says represents where I hope we are going as a species. He noted that it's also a loving tribute to the original Sulu, portrayed in the TV series and first batch of spin-off movies by now openly gay George Takei. Takei said he was nevertheless disappointed that a character thought to be heterosexual all this time is suddenly shown to be gay. He says he would have preferred a character who has a history of being gay rather than Sulu, who had been straight all this time, suddenly being revealed as being closeted. He said that Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry supported LGBT rights, but when the show originally aired in the 1960s, a gay character would have been way beyond pushing the envelope for network television, especially considering the stir created by a heterosexual interracial kiss between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhuru. But screenwriter Simon Pegg, who also stars as Chief Engineer Montgomery Scotty Scott in the upcoming film, said he respectfully disagrees with Takei about Star Trek's first out gay character. He told reporters that director Justin Lin and his co-writer all loved the idea of it being someone we already knew because the audience has a pre-existing opinion of that character as a human being, unaffected by any prejudice.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 9th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Marie Gilgeson.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Updating the news about Australia's national elections, vote counting continues, but the opposition has conceded victory to the coalition government of PM Malcolm Turnbull. Labour Party leader Bill Shorten said that while Turnbull had won the right to pursue his Liberal Party's policy agenda, Labour would stand firm on some of its priorities. One of those priorities just might be a vote in Parliament on marriage equality, rather than Turnbull's proposed plebiscite on the issue. Stay tuned. A trans teen's mom defends her against ignorance and hate, and performers lend their hands to a love offensive. Later in the program.
We got long stories,
short stories,
art stories,
sports stories,
books about the wild, wild west.
Yeehaw!
Scary tales.
We've even got some hairy tales.
It's hard to choose which ones are best.
So hard!
We got silly books.
Sad books.
Good books.
Bad books.
They're all great in their way. But whichever one you choose, hey, you just can't lose. Come on and read a book today.
If you're looking for a good book to read today, This Way Out Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason has a couple of suggestions.
Two books with queer subject matter that I read recently reminded me of everything that is wonderful about reading. Loving Eleanor, The Intimate Friendship of Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok by Susan Wittig Albert is a beautifully written and richly detailed historical novel that lets the reader fully enter the time span of journalist Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt's love affair and intimate friendship. The book also chronicles the sacrifices that both women had to make to keep the rumors at bay about their relationship. Hickok left the Associated Press, where she was a highly regarded reporter, because of a conflict of interest with her relationship with Eleanor, who was then the First Lady. She took government jobs as a writer and was transferred to remote locations. We hear the thoughts of Hickok firsthand in the writing of the author. I wasn't to linger in Washington, where gossip still linked my name with hers. I would later learn that Princess Alice had exclaimed loudly, and in a fashionable Washington restaurant, "I don't care what they say, I simply cannot believe that Eleanor Roosevelt is a lesbian." In Bull and Other Stories, Autumn House Press, lesbian author Kathy Anderson does not address a LGBT audience in most stories, but she does explore the queerness in the thoughts of married couples toward each other, employees and bosses of children to their parents, and of parents toward their children. She does so in such beautifully written and intriguing ways that I was turning the pages without a thought to the world around me. Her prose is often bitingly funny. In Dip Me in Honey and Throw Me to the Lesbians, Anderson gives us the thoughts of an upscale foodie lesbian. We are so not losers, Jane thought. This is proof. Look at us in a fabulous restaurant enjoying ourselves. Take that, ex-lovers. Reading these two books reminded me that reading helps you learn more about yourself, in addition to learning about the world in all of its time dimensions. Reading is like looking in a mirror and seeing things that not only have you never seen before, but things you never expected to see. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and leisure for This Way Out.
Art benefits life in a new Orlando tribute anthem you'll hear at the end of the show, and now in a new documentary about a pioneering trans teen and her ally mom that's coming soon to the Queer Film Festival circuit. Our Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones met the dynamic duo who took off.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Zoe Luna at 13 years old, challenged her school for the right to simply be herself. And in 2014, with the help of the ACLU, she won her case and opened the door for other trans kids to also be themselves. And we're also here with Zoe's mom, Ophelia Barbas, who has been her daughter's fierce ally throughout. You were in a loving, strong family that came together. But at some point, you, and this is, I think, what the film deals with, you realized that the community beyond your family or your immediate support system was not so supportive and was not, I mean, was cruel.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering when that began or when you started kind of realizing that this was not going to be easy for the rest of the world.
Well, I started noticing that it wasn't going to be easy right as I went into preschool, because that's actually how this whole story came about, I think. There was this one lady, she ended up following me to elementary school, just out of coincidence. So she was an aide, and I think, whatever, not about her. So she was upset because at dress-up time, I would always tend to be the princess or the secret detective woman, or I would be anything that was the woman, not the man. I wouldn't be the firefighter, and she was always upset with that and was just like, let me do me. And so she actually contacted, like, the supervisors of that, and they all, like, told my mom, they were like, I think she needs to go to counseling because this is a little
off,
yeah.
So she wasn't comfortable with Zoe's behavior, and we never told her she couldn't do that. So yeah. At home, she can be who she wanted to. She ran around with her hoodie jacket as her hair, towels, everything, and she played with my shoes, and so there wasn't any stopping, like, oh, you can't do that. You're not supposed to do that. Of course, there was moments of don't, because dad might get upset or it's causing problems. But this aide at the end of the day was not comfortable with it. So she needed something to happen. And she suggested to the director that they speak to me. The director spoke to me and said, you need to go to counseling. And I said, okay, let's do that.
Because she actually thought it was going to help, and it did.
Well, I needed it because I needed to get everybody on board at home. They were going to give me free counseling, and we were going to be able to settle the situation. I said, let's do it. And it was wonderful because not only did that counselor have knowledge about the LGBTQ community, gave me information, helped me work with my oldest daughter, my son. And so at the end of all this, it was half a year of therapy. I went home like, okay, I know where we're at. Then we had to figure out moving forward.
And you stayed in the same school through the whole transition.
Yes.
Yes.
So now how were the other students?
So the other students were, at the beginning when I first transitioned, they were fine. They were way better than compared to the teachers and the staff at that school. So it wasn't really a hard time with them. A couple of them were like, ew, you're going to go to hell. And I was like, okay, well, I'll see you there too. But then, so I just really got over the kid problem because I was just fighting to stay in the same class I was in and the same school with the teachers and the administrators. So it wasn't really a concern with the students.
So this brings us to the lawsuit.
When I contacted the ACLU, they told me this is the process that we suggest you do, which was file a complaint with the United States Department of Education.
And what was the complaint about? What were you asking for?
Discrimination. First of all, they wanted to expel her from school for out coming out, expel her from school for saying who she was and how she felt about herself. Everything was inappropriate that she talked about. I was given an ultimatum. Mm-hmm. You, through the fall break, Thanksgiving break, either you find somewhere to go, you let us help you, or if she gets in trouble one more time, we're going to expel her.
And getting in trouble meaning showing up as a girl?
In trouble was defending herself.
Yeah, so. Every time I would go to the office to tell them that I was being bullied by someone, they would always they would have meetings with the bully, and they would be like, how are we going to make this look like she did it to get herself into that position?
We never heard that, but that was
the feeling. That's what it looked like a lot of the time.
And there was a particular teacher you had an issue with.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Which is why all this started, was because on one occasion, he made her stand up in the middle of the class and recite a pledge that she would not be, what was that word?
That I wouldn't be obnoxiously loud.
Obnoxiously loud.
When I laughed just as regularly as every other student in the classroom, he just had a thing for me.
And then she wore feathers in her hair, clip-on feathers. I mean, she was starting to express. And the third one was where she came home and she said, I can't handle this anymore. I have to literally keep my head down in class and just cover my face, because if not, he'll pick on me and all the other kids will laugh at me. My last straw was, and this all happened in a span of about 2 weeks, he said, smile, brother, you look disgusting.
Because I had mascara run all over my face.
Yes, this is a teacher.
How did you survive this?
Well, I had my mom,
I went to the school, I actually wrote
the most beautiful emails I've ever seen in my life.
Email. I asked them why. I said, if you're a teacher, why would you do this? Why did you not call me?
Did you get an answer?
No.
Never.
Have you been afraid for Zoe's safety?
All the time. There is not one day that I'm not concerned. Am I worried that she can get hurt? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because she's young. She's very impressionable, even though she's very smart. And no, she's very mature for her age. That's also pretty scary.
Yeah.
But the whole thing, the fear is always going to be there. But if I don't let her present, if I go against it and I want to hide her away, who am I hurting the most? So I can't do that. I can't do that. I committed myself to being visible and being her advocate and her ally 100%.
You can find out more about Raising Zoe on Facebook and follow the film on Twitter. The music continues to flow with the tears in response to the Pulse massacre in Orlando, Florida. Here's the latest tribute song.
I can hold a gun and hold your heart. I can put out fires and make them start. Skin and bones and flesh and blood. With all this nerve, how did we get this numb? They can hurt, they can heal. They can give back or they can steal. They can break the world, but they can change it too.
sometimes. I've been watching news and seeing all this hate. And tell me, is it wrong to want a little change?
Performers like Tyler Glenn, Halsey, Adam Lambert, Mary Lambert, Troy Sivan, Alex Newell, Jussie Smollett, the Trans Chorus of Los Angeles, and RuPaul were joined by allies including Mary J. Blige, Jennifer Lopez, Britney Spears, and Gwen Stefani for this benefit single called, not surprisingly, Hands. Proceeds from downloads of the song, available exclusively at iTunes, will go to the Equality Florida Pulse Victims Fund, the GLBT Community Center of Central Florida, and the queer media watchdog group, GLAAD. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Michelle Marie Gilkison, Janet Mason, Randall Kleiser, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Between the Lions and Sly and the Family Stone performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information, pics of the crew, and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, KZYXNZ, Fort Bragg, Philo, Coastal Mendocino County, Willits, and Ukiah, California, CFUR, Prince George, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Race relations in this nation are troubled, even toxic. The South African playwright Athol Fugard has spent much of his life under apartheid. He's written about that toxic system, not in formal political terms, but from the standpoint of someone interested in the everyday, the interpersonal, the emotional consequences of prejudice and racism. Athol Fugard, now 84, is one of L. Peter Callender's favorite playwrights. Callender has performed in a number of Fugard's plays, including Master Harold and the Boys, currently playing at Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Peter Callender is also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, so he's thought a lot about racial dynamics and the situation of blacks and other people of color in the context of both theater and everyday life. Callender is a veteran actor, director, and writer. He's appeared in roles both on and off Broadway and internationally. When Peter joined me recently in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked him whether Master Harold and the Boys, a play about the apartheid-era relationship between a white teenage boy and two black servants of the boy's parents, whether the play constitutes a polemic, a frontal attack on the apartheid system.
I think all of his plays are a political critique. I think he started his theater as all very political theater. The Serpent Players were a bunch of ragtag actors. As a matter of fact, some of them weren't even actors. They just wanted to work with Fugard. So all of his plays have that political stint to them, the political colors, the political undertones. John Connie, Winston Shona, Zakes McKay, they were all underground political activists back in the 60s. So their desires were to find a voice for themselves, whether it was legal or illegal. As a matter of fact, when Fugard was working on these plays, the early plays, John Connie had never met him. John Connie, who became one of his collaborators with Cesare Bonzi Is Dead and The Island, hadn't even met him. And when they did meet, John Connie wanted to be an actor. And as a matter of fact, Fugard is like, no, what are you talking about? You're black in South Africa. You can't. And of course, John Connie and those guys, they had no relationships with white people. None at all. As a matter of fact, those guys thought that white people, if they were not in uniform, they were still police. They didn't trust them. So when the company was formed and these actors became actors with the company, it was all very political to get these plays out in the open. Most of them were banned. Most of them were, the police were everywhere, always in the audience. So they were very suspicious of everybody. But these plays had to be written and they had to be performed. So he doesn't necessarily write to say that polemic, fist up in the air, hatred of apartheid. He basically writes for audiences' self-examination. He wants them to listen to the play, examine their own racism, their own way of thinking about black-white situation, their own way of thinking about apartheid, their own way of thinking about South Africa. And he wanted them to witness something that goes on in the world of South Africa, in the world of apartheid. And hopefully, in listening to that and witnessing it, you may go out and do something about it, take some action. But he never says in his plays, do this, take action.
So it's a critique on a personal, on an interpersonal level.
Correct.
And how good was he at doing that in terms of saying something about apartheid in connection with and its influence on everyday life, as opposed to maybe, you know, the broader political situation?
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. We are only seeing, and forgive me if I don't know of many other South African playwrights. I'm sure there are several who are doing great work around the world and certainly around the country, their country and ours. But Fugard is the one that was first. He came out with these plays, and he was actually quite good at it and still is. Fugard was the genius at it. And writing plays and writing characters that are brilliantly sculpted, real people in real situations that astound, that astonish, that surprise, that engage audiences. And he never thought that audiences should just sit back in the dark. He wanted them to be active. He wanted the actors to be clear on what they're doing. That's why he also directs his own plays and acts in his own plays. He wanted the audience to be participators, not just sitting in the dark. As a matter of fact, he tells a story about a performance of Cesare Bonzi Is Dead back in South Africa. If you don't know it, it's about Cesare Bonzi is a black man who is out of the township and he wants to burn his name. He wants to get rid of his name and call himself something else. Actually, I think the name that he picked was Robert Zwenzela something. Anyway, in that particular play, there's a scene where he's actually talking about ripping up the passbook. And the audience was so taken by it that a lot of people left, got up and left because they knew the police were outside. There was these two black men talking about something that was communistic, was illegal, tearing up your passbook. You know, it was so real to the audience that some of them got up in fear. And when they realized that it was a play and it was okay, they sort of came back in very, very slowly. But that's how active, and that's what Fugard really loves, is getting the audience involved and getting them to know that, yes, we are talking about their lives, and he will be sharing these stories with the world.
Well, this play, Master Harold and the Boys, now at Aurora Theater in Berkeley, it was written in the early 1980s. It actually premiered in 1982. It was the first of Fugard's play to premiere outside his home country, South Africa, where it was initially banned. This is remarkable, isn't it? This playwright who engages with, as you said, a lot of black actors, a lot of fledgling black actors and performers who didn't want to have anything to do with whites, and in fact, in many situations, really couldn't really associate with whites. They needed their passbook to go into white areas. Talk about kind of the risks that were involved in Fugard writing these plays, associating with the people he did, and to my mind, and maybe to other people's minds, it sounds improbable that someone like him could actually have his plays produced in South Africa, which he did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he did, absolutely. And he talks a lot about the danger of playwriting in South Africa. He was always conscious of what was going on outside of the room. He performed in churches. He performed in community centers. There were times when the company was invited to a university, for example, in which there were all these caveats. For example, they cannot use the bathroom. They could not come in the front door. They could not talk to the audience before or after the show. There were so many restrictions to them. And the actor said, you know what, Athol, we are not going to do this. We're not too many restrictions. And Athol told them, this is why we are here. We are usually performing for people who are activists, who know our work, who wants to see our work. These are people who have never seen our work. We need to be here, and we need to abide by these restrictions and trust that we will get our work seen and understood and appreciated. And one by one, the actors came back. They literally left. Some of them actually got on buses to leave. And one by one, they came back after thinking about what Fugard said. So, yes, these plays, especially Master Harold and the Boy, certainly The Island, certainly Sis Wibanzi, these plays were banned. All of his works were banned because he was working with he was breaking the law. He was doing all, there had to be all kinds of new laws, new ways of getting around working with black actors in those days. And he found a way of doing that. As I said earlier, a lot of these, the police were everywhere. They were disruptive. They would find a way to shut them down. They would find a way to infiltrate. One of the best ways of infiltrating a group in South Africa in those days was to call someone an informer. If Zakes Makai said that John Connie was an informer, then John Connie would disappear. So a lot of actors were sent to Robben Island because somebody said, oh, he's an informer. As a matter of fact, one of the first and earliest performances of The Island was actually done in Robben Island by one of the actors that was put in jail. So he diligently knew all the restrictions, all the possibilities for arrest, but moved forward anyway with his works. And thank God he did, because now we have an amazing canon of work, which I have grown to love and appreciate over the years.
L. Peter Callender plays the role of Sam in Aurora Theatre Company's production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard, now at Aurora Theatre in Berkeley through July 31st. It's been extended through July 31st. The play, directed by Timothy Neer, also stars Andrew Heumann and Adrian Roberts. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this play, Master Harold and the Boys, is set in the year 1950 in South Africa in a tea house in Port Elizabeth. That's a city on the southeastern tip of South Africa. What's significant about the year 1950?
One of the highlights that this play takes place in 1950 is that apartheid started 2 years before. So here is this relationship between Sam Samela and Master Harold, Master Halley, and which was actually Athol's first name, Harold. It's autobiographical. We can talk about that later.
Certainly. And Master Halley, again, he's a white teenage boy, and he's the son of the parents who employ these two black servants in their tea room.
Correct.
Willie and Sam. Okay.
Correct. And they've known each other for 10 years, right? So imagine this father-son relationship, where Sam would make, Halley would come into his room and talk and read and tell stories, and Sam would make him a kite. Sam would go for walks with him. So Sam became, his father was alcoholic, his father was abusive, crippled in World War II. So his relationship with his father wasn't very good at all. So Sam became that surrogate father. So imagine this relationship over the years as a friendship. Certainly, yes, a black-white friendship, but a friendship nevertheless. And then one morning they wake up and Halley becomes Master Harold overnight because of the apartheid regime, because of the setting up of the apartheid laws. Sam continues calling him Halley. Sam is an older man. He raised Halley in a sense. So for him to go to call him Master Harold after all that time was just didn't sit well with him. But Willie, being younger and being not as connected as Sam, calls him Master Halley, or sometimes he actually calls him Master Harold. So that's one of the things that I think is remarkable, that this play takes place in 1950. Just imagine waking up and all these things, the whole world is different. I mean, and also the lots of past book laws were instituted. For example, and I'll share something with you and your audience. Although this is not mentioned in the play, it's not an important aspect in the play. The playwright didn't ask for it. The character speaks nothing about it. I asked Timothy Neer, our director, and the folks at Aurora, whom I love very, very much, to design me a passbook so that I can have that in my back pocket. Because Sam and Willie would definitely have to have had that passbook in their pocket all the time. It's like walking around a different country if you don't have your passport with you. Things can go awry. So it was not mentioned in the play. It's not a design thing in the play, but I had them do it just for authenticity, to have that book in my back pocket. So this was all brand new. They had to carry a passbook. They could not go from one border town to another. The township laws were instituted. Population registration had to be taken care of. So all these new restrictions took place in 1950. And these men, they had no choice, but they had a job, and they had a good job, and they've had a job for a very long time. So Sam and Willie actually were very lucky to be where they were.
Now, you mentioned this play is autobiographical. So tell us about Harold, which is, again, you said Harold Athol Fugard was his real name, and here is this Master Harold called Halley by Sam. So what was Athol Fugard's young life like? What did his mother do that related to incidents we see in the play, scenes we see in the play?
Very, very similar. His father was an alcoholic. His father was abusive. His mother ran a tea room, exactly as Halley mentioned. It is completely autobiographical. The event of the play, and how do I tell this without giving too much away? Fugard, as a young man, Harold, was very tortured, in a sense, not physically tortured, of course, but his parents, the word we call it now is dysfunctional. There was no fun in that dysfunctional place. And he talks about that very openly in one of the monologues that Halley has in the play. One day, Sam and Halley had an argument about something, whatever that was. And I think it could have been after the apartheid regime took place in 2 years before the play starts. So as Sam was leaving to go home, Halley got on his bike and followed him and did something that a young boy who's hurt and privileged might do to a black man in South Africa, something very disrespectful. And I'll save that for the play. And Fugard, now in his 80s, has never gotten over that moment in his life, never gotten over the fact that he did this to this man who was his best friend, who was his father figure. Sam never overcame it. Sam never came back to the tea room. Sam didn't ballroom dance anymore. His entire life changed because of that one moment. You put him against apartheid, he can deal with that. You put him against 44 million blacks being controlled by 7 million whites, you can deal with that. That's a political thing. But when that kind of personal disrespect comes from a friend, a young man who he thought was a son to him, that shook him to the core. And Sam never overcame it, and neither did Athol Fugard. And he wrote this play in order to try to exorcise that demon from his soul. And he's still working on doing that.
We're going to talk not really about the end of the play because we don't want to give too much away, but what comes out at the beginning and at the midpoint of the play, I think, is that Sam has a vision of a world, of a different world. And in fact, Halley, or Master Harold, also has a vision. Can you talk a little bit about those visions and the hope that they express, and it's probably Fugard's hope, about where South Africa could go, you know, at a time when apartheid was, when society was deep in apartheid?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's brilliant the way Fugard constructs the play. There's this young white 17-year-old kid who is tortured and is shackled in his own home, in his own mind, by in a dysfunctional home, in a place where he's not very happy at all, and he finds solace in Sam's room, talking with Sam and talking with Willie and playing games and flying kites. That gave him his freedom. Sam and Willie living in the world of apartheid, the destructive, again, also torturous, also psychologically beaten down in the world of apartheid. And yet they find ways of communicating through education, through reading, through mathematics, through English books, through helping Sam helping Willie with his homework. Oh, sorry, with Hallie with his homework, talking about having great debates about religion and about social reform, and so they both have a wish to break away from their own internal shackles and their own internal sense of being put down. So they both create worlds, and Sam's thinking of a world without collision. Sam Samela, the real Sam Samela, was also a ballroom dancer. He took ballroom lessons and loved ballroom dancing. So the metaphor for Sam, and certainly through Fugard's writing, Sam is telling Hallie about how beautiful ballroom dancing is and how wonderful it is to be one of those couples on that dance floor. It's beautiful. And Hallie's like, no, Sam, it's not beautiful. It may be entertaining, but it's not beautiful. And Sam says, yes, it's beautiful. And he says, why? He says, to be one of the competitors on that dance floor is like being in a dream about a world where accidents don't happen. And Hallie gets it at that particular moment. It's a beautiful dream. And that's the dream that Sam wants. And I think all your listeners, if they just think about it for a second, to be in a world without collisions. You pick up a newspaper and you're reading about certain collisions, big collisions, all quote-unquote collisions happening all around the world. People are dying. Countries are clashing and collisions are happening all over the world. And Sam's idea is, if the world can be a dance floor in which everyone is dancing and the music is playing and everyone is moving in rhythm to the music, that's a beautiful world. It's a beautiful specter of existence. And I think that's Sam's world. And Sam convinces Hallie for a moment that is a beautiful world to be in.
It's a very powerful metaphor, dance is, as freedom, as beauty, as pointing to something higher and better. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And L. Peter Callender joins me in studio. He is an award-winning veteran actor who has appeared in roles both on and off Broadway and internationally. He's also a director and a writer, and he plays the role of Sam in Aurora Theater Company's current production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard that's now at Aurora Theater in Berkeley. For tickets, you can call 510-843-4822. That's 510-843-4822. Or you can visit auroratheater.org. Peter is also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company, and I'll ask him about that work a bit later this hour. There are major shifts in this play, shifts in tenor and tone and emotion. I wonder if you could talk about how good Fugard is at sort of charting and effecting these shifts, these sometimes abrupt breaks from what comes before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what makes this play brilliant in its simplicity and torturous and provocative in its depth. He starts the play with Sam and Willie on a little downtime at their work, and Willie is talking about, you know, he's getting it. He's getting the dance step. He's getting it. He's learning it. And of course, Sam as teacher to Willie, and of course to Hallie as well. And Fugard sets it up at the very beginning, and we learn that Willie has a little violent tendency with his girlfriends. Sam admonishes him for that. So we know that Willie has his own problems outside of, and that's how Willie gets his frustration and his anxieties out. With Sam, it's ballroom dancing. That's how he lives in his world. Then Hallie comes in, and we instantly know, speaking of shifts, there's an instant shift when Hallie comes in, because here are these two men of equal status, in a sense. They're both black in South Africa, right? There's an equal status there. Sam may be more of the patriarch than Willie. But then as soon as Hallie comes in, there's a shift. Master Hallie, and there's a difference in the way Sam behaves, there's a difference in the way Willie behaves. Then what I call the first ripple of earthquake that the audience barely notices, but it's there. It's when Sam tells Hallie that his father is on his way home.
His father is at the hospital?
That's correct. And his mother is... It sounded to Sam that his mother is about to go get his father. That's... You know, when we talk about a tsunami, when we talk about the beginning of a tsunami that no one recognizes it, no one knows where it is, it's 40, 50 miles, 60, 70, 120 miles out to sea, and you don't see it, it's just a little tiny wave, but it's there, and it's happening, and you barely notice it. It's imperceptible until, of course, it reaches shore. Then it's completely devastating. Those are the tiny little shifts that Fugard puts in. So the one shift, Daddy's coming home. When? I don't know, but be sure of what you heard, Sam. I am sure. No, Sam, you can't be sure. That's the first shift. Then the second shift, phone rings. It's his mother. Third shift, the ballroom dance. So little bits and pieces. And Fugard says something in the play that the audience very seldom gets. And I, if you see the play again, you know what I mean. He has Hallie say, creating a relaxed atmosphere, which will change to one of tension and drama as the climax is approached. Because Sam is talking about the setting up of the competition, of the ballroom dance competition, when everything is going to be beautiful, everything is going to be lovely, and that's what he's doing with the play. He's setting up the audience to believe that, oh yeah, this is wonderful. Look at these black people and white people getting along so beautifully. Oh my gosh, they're talking about history and math and science and all these wonderful topics, and then suddenly everything comes to a stop. The phone rings. Hallie's father is at home. And then the proverbial blank hits the fan. And that's when we realize, oh my gosh, wow, it's not real. It is a very tense world. It is a very dangerous world. And I think Fugard intentionally makes it a very dangerous world suddenly. And the audience has to be aware of that, that anything could happen in this room at this particular time. And it almost does.
It's also a testament to the fact that, and you're a director, you're an actor, you've been involved in the theater for a long time, that you don't need a lot of scene changes or shifts in time to deliver a dramatic punch.
Absolutely not. And interesting you should say shifts in time. No, there are no scene changes in this play from beginning to end. 91 and a half minutes. It's basically one long scene in which Fugard brings these people's lives into the forefront and entertains and shocks and mortifies in a certain way the audience. But the shifts in time happen, again, almost subliminally. The play takes place within an hour and a half. The time from the time Hallie comes in to the end of the play is about an hour and a half, the time itself. And there are tiny shifts in which, and I don't want to give too much away, but there are tiny shifts in time in which Hallie reverts to this, to his father. We start with the fun of the past, the days of old, and then the shift in time happens when Hallie realizes what's going on in his real life, and he becomes this apartheid, young, apartheid, domineering young man. Instantly, that shift in time happens almost imperceptibly, but the audience knows something has happened. Hallie has either become what his father is or what every other white man in South Africa will become, now has permission to become. And that's the biggest shift in time that you'll see in the play.
So I read a number of reviews of this play, Master Harold and the Boys, now at Aurora Theatre Company in Berkeley, and a number of critics said, you know, this is an important play to see. It has great relevance to what's happening today in terms of racial justice and racial injustice. One critic, though, did say that she was struck by the fact that this play encourages viewers to congratulate themselves on how enlightened they are in terms of racial attitude and racial perception. And at this point in time, we don't really need people to congratulate themselves on being so enlightened. We need, in fact, for white folks, for example, to realize that there's still a lot of work to be done. Do you have any reaction to that?
I agree with the latter. I think there's a great deal of work to be done. The fact that we're doing this play in 2016, a play that was written in 1982, a play that takes place in 1950, and we are still dealing with racial issues in this country in the similar ways where acts of violence, acts of rudeness and racism is happening. This interview is going on right now, and outside those doors, there are people harming other people with just words and looks and trust issues. So we've not come very far, actually. And I don't necessarily feel, and I don't know if I think people congratulate themselves for being enlightened. I think this play says to people, you know what? This is what it was. Think on your own life. Think on when you get back on BART. Think of when you get back in your car, as you drive down University, as you drive down Shattuck or Addison, or you get on the freeway, 580, 880, whatever freeway you get on. Think of where you're going. Think of what will happen with you tomorrow. Think of the way you treated that person of color 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Think of your child at university. Think of your child going to school. How do you teach that child about that? And it just reminds us that we are still in a world where collisions do happen. And I don't think people are saying, I am really enlightened now. Thank you so much. This play reminds me of how wonderful I am. Certainly there are going to be people out there who think that. I share a story very briefly. I did Sizwe Banzi is Dead and The Island at Portland Stage Company 120 years ago. beautiful play, as with all Fugard plays. The audiences love it. Standing ovations everywhere. And we did it, Sizwe Banzi is Dead, intermission, The Island. And we got standing ovations. You know, we leave the theater. We'd leave the stage. The audience would continue to applaud. We'll come back in and take another bow. And because the actors were just in khaki shirt and shorts, there was not much changing of costume and get back into street clothes. And we had our heads shaved bald for the show because we were in Robben Island prison and that was the norm. And as we left the theater, people were still in the audience and certainly still in the lobby and just filtering out onto the streets. So in 8 minutes from the time we took our curtain call to the time we were going through the lobby and out in the streets, we went from celebrated actors on stage to two black men in Portland, Maine at 10:30 at night. And I have never, talk about time shifts, I had never experienced anything like that thus far in my life, and certainly not since then. Yes, certain things in different ways, but to have 300 people applaud you, loving your work, and then 8 minutes later, you go from celebrity to two dangerous black men, in which women, white women, were clutching their purses, and men were getting in the way because, and they didn't recognize us. So people may feel somewhat enlightened, and I think there are enlightened. I think Sam says it in the play. He says, I reckon there are a few people who've got past just dreaming about it and are doing something real. So Fugard acknowledges that. There are people who are doing something real, but there are most of the people who are not. And hopefully this play will say, what can I do? How can I reexamine who I am? Where have I been? Where am I going tomorrow? What my beliefs are? And I think that's what he wishes audience to leave the theater with this from this play.
Peter Callender joins us in studio. He plays an important role, a key role, the role of Sam in a production of Master Harold and the Boys, a play by Athol Fugard. It's now at Aurora Theater in Berkeley through July 31st. We'll take a short break and then speak more with Peter. And we're going to shift gears because he also happens to be artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. And I want to talk with him about race and the Bard and a whole lot else. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I'm joined in studio by L. Peter Callender. He has worked with all of the major theater companies in the Bay Area. He's an award-winning actor. He's also a director. He's appeared in a number of films as well. And again, we've been mentioning that he's a big part of Aurora Theater Company's production of Master Harold and the Boys. He's also artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. And, you know, a lot of people, Peter, would not associate African Americans with Shakespeare. They wouldn't think about blacks and Shakespeare together. Is that a lack of imagination, or is it something else?
It's both. It's yeah. You know, we were just talking about Fugard, and just one more quick thing, because we did say Shakespeare. Fugard, in his company with the Serpent Players, they did lots of Shakespeare. From Othello to Titus Andronicus, they did the Greeks. They loved Sophocles. He did lots of Antigone. So when people say, well, black actors doing Shakespeare, like Hallie says in the play, what does a black man know about making a kite? Everyone has these ideas that we are not allowed. We can't fly a kite. We don't know about those. That's a white person thing. We can't do ballet. That's a white person thing. We can't sing opera. It is wrong. It is insensitive. It's ridiculous. I guess I can come up with some other phrases, but I won't. Look, I've been doing Shakespeare. I've done 27 of Shakespeare's plays over the years. I am very proud of the work that I have done on Shakespeare. I teach acting Shakespeare at Stanford University. I teach fundamentals of directing also down there. I've coached actors on Shakespeare over the years. It is one of the playwrights that I understand intrinsically. It's deep in my DNA. I love his work. I cherish the idea of doing a Shakespeare play. I want to do a Shakespeare play every year, whether it's plays that I've done before over and over again, which there are several. Some of the best actors that I have worked with on Shakespeare have been black actors and black actresses. There's something about the topic. There's something about Shakespeare as a political writer. There's something about Shakespeare as a race writer. It's certainly in Othello, certainly in Merchant of Venice, Midsummer Night's Dream, where one of the characters talk about because I am dark. He's written all these incredible plays that anyone that has an understanding about life, anyone that cares about life, should do. It's not a matter. It's not a white world as far as Shakespeare is concerned. I think I do it well. I think the people that I've worked with do it well. White, black, yellow, tall, short, Asian, it doesn't matter. I think it's just what comes from the heart with Shakespeare. And that's why, as artistic director of African American Shakespeare Company, I just want everyone to... Sherry Young, the executive director and founder, former ACT grad, she founded the theater in order that actors of color, not just African American, just actors of color in general, get the opportunity to do what other people, as you started this conversation by saying, other people say we should not or perhaps could not do. There was once a time that Alvin Ailey was told that black people in general can't do ballet. Well, you know, hello, Misty Copeland, right? Mm-hmm. One of the greatest ballerinas in the world right now, and she's black. So there goes that.
Do you see the African American Shakespeare Company as being part of a genealogy, as following other previous efforts to bring African Americans to Shakespeare, whether it's in the realm of acting or viewing?
Let me say this. A man whose life I emulate, who was a great political mover and shaker in the world, a Paul Robeson, in whom I share an historical footnote, as a matter of fact, a theatrical historical footnote, one of the greatest black Shakespeare actors. There's a wonderful book by Eric Hill called Shakespeare in Ebony. Beautiful book. I believe that's the title. Ira Aldridge, recently played by Carl Lumley, directed by Margot Hall, in a play called Red Velvet, done at San Francisco Shakes. He played Othello in London and was almost booed off the stage because he was a black actor playing Othello, which was uncalled for. It was, you know, white actors only played these roles.
How long ago was this about?
This is in the 30s, I believe. So their early leadership brought us to the point where we can say this: we can own Shakespeare. We can make it our own. We can tell these stories through our own eyes and tell them well, if not better, than other theater companies and other parts of the world. That we can say we can take ownership of that. And I think Shakespeare would be very proud of that, because I do believe that Shakespeare, not I believe, it is a fact, that Shakespeare wrote most of his plays for the people. It was written certainly for the hierarchy in a certain extent because they were commissioned, but he wrote it for the people, and he wrote it for the time that these plays took place. There were contemporary audiences, so we should take Shakespeare and do them in our contemporary styles, because that's what Shakespeare did in his time. And I think there are many theater companies and many actors that have gone before us that we are saying, let's pick up the mantle at African American Shakespeare Company and highlight the fact that actors of color are capable, are knowledgeable, are excited about doing these works, and we can do it very, very well.
How much are you driven in what you want to do today and what you do today by the fact that you, as I've learned, you were the only African-American actor in many productions of classic plays in earlier years when you were an actor coming up?
I just want to give back. I had the great pleasure of being trained at the Juilliard School, the High School of Performing Arts. I studied in London. I studied with Tadashi Suzuki in Togomura, Japan. I have had the opportunity to work with some of the greatest directors that this country has produced in wonderful theaters across the country. And I want to take all that knowledge, all that work, all that learning, and give back to a lot of the young people that are coming up today. And it's something that means a lot to me. When I first came out to perform here in the Bay Area, my friend and colleague Tony Taccone brought me in to do Adolphus Cousins in Major Barbara. I was the only African-American member of that cast. There was one particular actor who didn't think that he thought actually that I might mess up his play. And so he would give me a hard time. It took him about 15 years or so, having seen me in another show, to come backstage to apologize. But yes, over the years, I had been the only actor in a company of white actors in classic plays. And I held my head high because I knew that my training was good. I knew that my artistic ability was strong. My desire was strong. And I knew that I belonged there. And that, again, is what the mission, the values of the African American Shakespeare Company. We want actors to know that you belong. You can carry this play. And I have been guided by that strength, knowing fully well that yes, I am it. And when audiences come to the theater and they see me, they're going to see an actor who has done his work, an actor who is strong, determined, knows his craft, and is willing to take huge chances in order to certainly prove himself, but to let other actors know that yes, you can do this.
L. Peter Callender joins us in studio. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain. He is artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. He's been an artistic associate at California Shakespeare Theater since 1994. He's a native of Trinidad in the West Indies. He came to the U.S. in 1969. And you, as you say, you enjoy working with young actors. You like to bring young actors in. You have said something like, you don't want young actors to think too much about the lines in Shakespeare's plays, but to say them. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at a line of Shakespeare and you start thinking about, oh, my gosh, it looks so complicated. I don't know what those words mean. Why is that verb before this? And if you think about it too much, you will overthink it. You will look at it and think, I can't do this. But if you read it, and then you have someone say, this is what that line means, and then paraphrase it in the way you would speak, then say what Shakespeare wrote, then paraphrase it again, you will find that what Shakespeare wrote is exactly what you're thinking. So don't think about it too much. Just say it. It doesn't matter what the line is. It doesn't matter which character says it. Just find your truth in it. Find the meaning of it. Think what you mean and say what you mean. But don't think about the line itself. Think about the thought, the idea, the emotion that comes from that line. And then you will, then we as the audience will feel what you're feeling.
Can you understand, though, people's frustration? It's a frustration that I sometimes share, that Shakespeare is difficult to understand.
Of course. Some people find Ibsen or Chekhov or the Greeks hard to understand. Of course. Some people find Susan Laurie Parks hard to understand. I mean, and they are, because they're deep. It's deep thought. It's not just putting a pencil to paper. It's deep, complicated ideas and thoughts, and you have to open your mind to that. You can't just look at it. Look, you go to an art museum and you see a beautiful work of art. Some people look at it and, I don't get it. Why are the eyes way down there? And what's the nose on the top of the... What's his name? Picasso? What? That's ridiculous. But if you study it, you will learn the reason why he did that. Why? And it's the same with Shakespeare. Words are in different places, so you can't just say, "Well, I just don't get it," and leave it alone. No, it's complicated. It's complex. Look at it, understand it, read it, draw it out, say it. Look up words. There's tons of scholarship out there. Dig it out. Find it. We at African American Shakespeare Company, and at most companies I've done Shakespeare, there's very little adding of words. There's cutting of Shakespeare. You have to cut Shakespeare. It's just some of the archaic phrases in our language may be difficult to understand. But we don't add words, and we change scenes, but we never add our own words to simplify. We never dumb down Shakespeare for anybody. We make sure that the actors understand completely. Example, we just did a production of Romeo and Juliet with age-appropriate actors, right? Romeo 16, Juliet 15. And we went to San Francisco School of the Arts. We went to the Oakland School of the Arts. We went to the French American School. And we got actors of color to come in and audition for us. And we picked two Romeos, two Juliets, plus all the Tybalts. Everyone was young. And I sat with them for 10 days at a conference room, word for word, line by line, thought by thought. And one actor, after the fourth or fifth day, brought me to tears. Of course, I cry at open parking spaces in San Francisco. But he said to me, he says, "Mr. Callender, I think I've hit the jackpot." And there's a 15-year-old black kid talking about, "I love Shakespeare. I didn't understand this before. I didn't know what I was looking at. Now you're telling me, oh, this is what is, this is, oh, that's deep. Can I say it now? Can I say it now?" And that's what we want. We want that excitement to say, "Now I understand it. Oh, I want to say that. I want to say that." And when they, in rehearsals or even late performances, they were quoting Shakespeare. We went out to dinner after the cast party, and they were quoting Shakespeare. They'd never done that before. That fills me up. And that's why we are there as teachers, as directors, as movers and shakers, as a theater company that's struggling right now. And we can talk about that in a minute. But we are there to enlighten, to enhance the lives of audiences and kids. One young lady, after seeing a production of Twelfth Night, she went into her pocket and she gave me her lucky penny. She said, "I've been carrying around this penny for a long time. I don't have a lot of money, but I want you to have this because I understood Twelfth Night, and I want you to know that I understood, and I want to support your theater." She gave me her. I still have it. So, and she was a young Caucasian girl, and I thought to myself, "This is that's why we are there."
Would you then? I mean, should, in your opinion, people read Shakespeare's plays
out loud,
right, and study them before they go see them?
I would recommend if you are going to see Midsummer Night's Dream or Romeo and Juliet or Winter's Tale. We're doing Winter's Tale next year. Yes, I would recommend that you look up something. There are all kinds of scholarships on the internet. Type in the Winter's Tale. You're going to get a plethora of pages on Shakespeare's Winter's Tale. Look at it. Read the synopsis of the play. And then open up a PDF and look at the first few lines lines of the play. There's something called Shakespeare with No Fear Shakespeare. Look that up. See that it, one side of the page is Shakespeare, the other side is a translation, in a sense. Look that up. Find out a little bit about the play. Don't come in absolutely cold. You may go to, again, I refer to going to museums, to artwork. If you're looking, you go to the De Young for an Escher or Picasso exhibit, you know, you may want to look up those if you've never seen them before. Or you just may want to go and appreciate it by what, but you have to read something about it. And I would recommend that. And then come in and enjoy it. Back in the old days at Cal Shakes, there were, and we always laughed at this, but people did it. The audience members would come in with the complete works of Shakespeare. Or they would come in with the play, the Arden version, or the Signet Classic, or the Pelican version. And they would sit there in the front row, whichever row they're in. And as we were performing, they would be turning the pages and reading it with us.
Wow.
Right? And they would get a little perplexed because sometimes we would cut and trim and paste. And they would, oh my gosh, turning pages frantically, trying to find where we are. But that took place. Not as much anymore, but I'm sure it still happens elsewhere.
The African American Shakespeare Company, of which you are artistic director, is currently based at 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco. You said it's struggling.
Yeah, we are in a major transition right now. We are we're looking for a space. We have been at the Burial Clay Theater for about 9 years now. I became artistic director about 6 years, and it's in the African American Arts and Culture Complex. And it's under new leadership, and we are discovering that most of our time in the theater for our build, our tech, our rehearsals is being taken away from us in order that more organizations get to use the theater, which in a sense is a good thing, but we're being squeezed out a little bit because we can no longer produce. We usually do 4 shows a year. We bring in over 4,000 students to see the shows for free from around the Bay Area. That may have to stop. We hire over 100 artisans, designers, set designers, costume designers of color. We are trying to maintain that. We are currently looking for a home for the African American Shakespeare Company. We're looking in Oakland. We're looking in San Francisco. There are places that are interested in housing us temporarily, but we feel that we know we are one of the only producing theater companies in the region. Lorraine Hansberry, headed by my friend Stephen Anthony Jones, they are producing some works, but they are usually doing readings in different places. The African American Shakespeare Company is the only theater company that's doing what we do in the region. And there's a possibility that it might all come to an end. We do not want that to happen. We will find a space. The San Francisco Opera is helping us out. There's a theater in the Bay Theater in San Francisco that we're looking at. We're looking at the Strand on Mission, ACT Strand Theater. We're looking everywhere. We need to find a space that we can call our own, that we can continue to do the type of work that is so desperately needed. Look, people tell me, you know, Peter, you know, you're very talented, you're this, you're that, you could be anywhere in the country. Why are you in Oakland? Why are you in San Francisco? Why are you artistic director of this theater? I do it because I love theater. I do it because I love working with young people. I do it because the Bay Area is one of the greatest theater hubs in the country. That's why I'm here. And I do not wish this theater company or any other small theater company that's doing what they are doing or what we're doing to disappear. There are so many companies of folding in the Bay Area right now, and I do not want to be one of them. So we're working very, very hard. Sherry Young and I and our board, we're looking, and we're hoping that one day our phone would ring. And somebody would say, I have a space for you. Or a donor would say, here's this amount of money. Begin your capital campaign to build. That's what we're waiting for. In the meantime, we will produce wherever we will produce. It will be successful, and we will do a great job with it.
L. Peter Callender. He's artistic director of the African American Shakespeare Company. And you can see him on stage at Aurora Theater in Berkeley in a production of Athol Fugard's play Master Harold and the Boys, which runs through July 31st. For tickets, you can call 510-843-4822, or you can visit Aurora Theater Company online via the link we've placed on againstthegrain.org. There you'll also find a link to the African American Shakespeare Company. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for this opportunity.
And this is Sia suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and much more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.